Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken, so to speak.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our Patreon donors. If you'd like to become a Patreon donor yourself, please go to the website bodybuildinglegendshow.com, and in the upper right-hand corner, you will see the link to become a Patreon donor. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. And on today's show, we will be continuing our end of the year review that we do with Jerry Branum every year. And I know we are already at the end of January, but we are still wrapping it up. And we are now on the year 1992, because if you're new to the show, we go back 30 years, 40 years, and 50 years. So 2022 just ended. So we already covered 1972, and we covered 1982. And on this episode, we will be covering 1992. So Jerry and I start our discussion with this episode, part one of the amateur shows that took place in 1992. And of course, we go off on our tangents and talk about other things. But basically, the competitions we are covering was the 1992 NPC USA Championships that Flex Wheeler won. And this was the contest where Flex got his pro card. And he was in such outstanding shape. He was really the talk of bodybuilding that year because everybody felt like Flex was going to be a great pro, which he was. And they felt like if he went into the Mr. Olympia that year, he could possibly have won it because he was in such unbelievable condition. And we'll also talk about the 1992 IFBB North America Championships that were won by Paul Dillette from Canada. And this was also Paul's pro qualifier by winning the overall at the North America contest. He was able to turn pro, and him and Flex were like the two big pros that competed the next year in 1993. Unfortunately, we did not cover the NPC Nationals, which we should have. So I will mention that when we get done with our show. I will mention it before we leave in the outgoing remarks of the winners of that competition. I don't know how Jerry and I forgot that. We just got so wrapped up in talking about all the other contests and all the other things that we kind of forgot it before we went on to the pros. So next week, we will talk about the professional events of 1992, which includes the Arnold Classic that was won by Vince Taylor and the Night of the Champions that was won by Kevin Lavroni in his first pro year, because Kevin won the 1991 NPC Nationals. So he turned pro in 92. And then, of course, we'll talk about the 1992 Mr. Olympia contest, which was won by Dorian Yates, and that was held in Helsinki, Finland. And then when we get done with our interview today with Jerry, I am going to read another article from 1982. I actually had a couple articles from 1992 about Flex winning the USA, but they were mostly contest report articles, not too exciting. And I came across this article, I don't know how I missed this, from Muscle and Fitness. So last week I read an article from the Flex magazine that covered the 1982 Mr. Olympia. Well, in Muscle and Fitness, Rick Wayne wrote his article about the 1982 Olympia, and it is very, very entertaining and very detailed. So I have to read this for you guys. I have to share this since we did that other one last week from Flex magazine. We can't miss Rick Wayne's article, right? So I will be reading this article. It's called Beef, 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 The Showdown of the Year When Bodybuilding Was Touted as the Sport of the 80s. And this is the 1982 Olympia conclusion. So this is pretty exciting. So like I said, I'll read that as soon as our interview with Jerry finishes up. All right. I got an email that I want to share with you guys. This comes from Mike from Canada. And Mike said, "Hey, John, I just want to once again tell you how much I love your show and what a fantastic job you do. It was a pleasant surprise to see that your last show consisted entirely of you reading articles. I loved it because the articles are just as enjoyable as the interviews, and I always look forward to them. I had in the past meant to suggest to you to have some shows entirely comprised of articles when no guests were available. However, I do have one personal suggestion. I personally find the contest articles and other personality stuff much more interesting than training articles, but that's just my own personal opinion. Muscle Go Round and Iron Man's news and views were always fun, so maybe they would be a good read as well. On another note, I was actually at that Detroit Pro show when I was 18 years old in 1987. I only went to the pre-judging and not the night show, but as was mentioned in the article, it was an awkward experience because for the pre-judging, I honestly don't think there could have been more than 50 people in attendance. Wow. So the promoters really dropped the ball for that show, and we felt uncomfortable for the athletes. That said, Mike Ashley and Shane DeMora were lights ahead of the other competitors in terms of conditioning. And for some reason, the first thing I remember about that show was Mike and Shane's rear delts when they walked out. They appeared to explode from their shoulders and was indicative of their outstanding condition. Thanks again for the great shows. And also, I also just recently ordered your book, Bodybuilding Heroes and Legends, Volume 1, and I'm really looking forward to receiving it. All the best, Mike from Canada. All right, Mike, thank you for that great email, and I'm glad you enjoyed last week's episode where I read articles from some old bodybuilding magazines. And yes, I will be doing that again in the future when we don't have any guests. I was just looking when I found this article from Rick Wayne in the 1982 Muscle and Fitness. I could not believe the amount of great articles. I've got all these boxes of magazines, and I got this one box where it's probably like from 1981 to 1983 Muscle and Fitness. And some of the articles in there were just fantastic. When Lee Haney first turned pro, when he won the Nationals. And I agree with you, Mike. I love the personality pieces and the contest reports a lot more than the training articles, which I'll concentrate more on that. So if you guys got any comments or suggestions, you can just email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com. And we will also be having Roy Callender on the show. I'm supposed to interview him today. So Roy has a new app out for his training program. You know, Roy is one of the best trainers in Canada. He received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Canadian Bodybuilding Federation out there as a trainer of a lifetime trainers. So we're going to talk to Roy about that. And of course, I'll ask him some other questions about his great bodybuilding career as well. We won't just talk about that. So that might be coming up next week, but that'll be coming up at least in the next couple of weeks. And I'm working on getting some other interviews with some other legends of the sport. Stay tuned for that as well. All right. I think that's all I got, guys. So here is our interview with Jerry Branum, where we talk about the year 1992. And we are going to concentrate on the amateur competitions from that year in this interview. Here we go. All right. Welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And I'm here again with my good friend, Jerry Branum. And we are doing our end of the year review, where we go back 50 years, 40 years, and 30 years. So, Jerry, we've already covered the years 1972 and 1982, and now we're going back to 1992. And it's kind of funny that when we go back 30 years now, we're in the 90s. I remember when this podcast started 5 years ago, if we talked about 30 years ago, it was the 80s, but now we're into the 90s because we just ended with 2022. So we're going to talk about the year 1992, and in part one of our interview, we're going to talk about the amateur shows, which mostly would be the NPC, right? Because I think by this time, the AAU had kind of lost its strength, and the NPC was really taken over.
Were they still holding AAU American 92?
Yeah, I'm looking at the list here, and they still had the AAU shows going. The guy who won the AAU America that year was Mike Scarsella, and I was looking at the list of the competitors. And I don't really recognize, honestly, I don't recognize anybody on this list. So it wasn't any big names, you know.
And that contest got almost no publicity at all.
Yeah, I think all the competitors realized that if you want to be in the magazines, you got to go with NPC and with Weider, right? Because, I mean, that of course led to the Mr. Olympia. Yeah. And by this time, they had the Arnold Classic going and the Night of the Champions. And yeah. I think... Yeah, there was just nowhere to go with the AU. It was just amateur, so yeah. I think everybody wanted to be a pro by this time.
That guy Mike, who won, I vaguely remember what he looked. He was a pretty good bodybuilder, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
He was a pretty clear winner at that year.
Yeah, I think around 1990, it really dropped off. You know.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah. So this is 10 years after the NPC started, because it started in 1982, and we covered that on our last show. Yeah. And this is going to be good talking to you, Jerry, because you were working for Joe Weider's magazine and you were at a lot of these amateur shows and a lot of the professional shows.
That's right. That's the great perk. I was just sent a message to my friend Richard Baldwin mentioning this. The biggest perk about writing for Joe Weider was he'd send me to all the big shows, the national shows and the international IFBB show. If the Olympia was in Europe, I'd go.
Yeah. That
is the thing I most enjoyed about working for Joe Eder.
Yeah.
The rest I couldn't get, you know, but that was great.
So yeah.
I did go to all the major shows. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's cover some of these MPC shows. I mean, I guess we could talk about the Junior Nationals before we get to the USA and the Nationals, which are the big ones. And those were the, and it's also worth mentioning too, because I know things have changed a lot, since this time, since 30 years ago. But back then, when the MPC first started in 1982, the only way you could turn professional was you had to win your class at the Nationals, and then you had to go to the Mr. Universe, the IFBB World Championships, and you had to win your class at the Mr. Universe. If you didn't, you had to go back, start over again, and go back to the Nationals.
Yeah.
But I think now this is 10 years later, so things had changed. So now, I don't know what year it changed, but they said that once you won your class at the Nationals, you didn't have to go to the Universe anymore. You were already a pro. And then in 1987, the year Mike Quinn won the USA, they said the guy who wins the overall USA, not the classes, but the overall, he can also turn pro. And then I think also the North America. The North America was actually an IFBB contest because it was not only the USA, it was Mexico and Canada as well. So right. They said the overall there. So I think now you're up to like six guys, right? Six guys a year that could turn pro.
Right, which is still reasonable.
That's small, yeah.
It's gotten ridiculous today, John. Let's face it.
Yeah, it's hundreds of people now.
I mean, I see these people on Facebook, and they like to list themselves as Joe Schmo, IFBB Pro.
Right.
Mary Jones, IFBB Pro. Look, I understand they're proud of being a pro. I'm not trying to make fun of them, but there's so many of these people. I've never heard – well, all right, it's true. I don't go to the contests anymore. I don't read any bodybuilding magazines. So I really don't know anything about these people, but it seems like this – so many of them, it seems like just about anybody can get a pro card as long as you win the contest, it seems.
Plus, we got all the divisions, too. It's not just bodybuilding. It's, you know, back then it was just men and women's bodybuilding, right?
Yeah, you know, you got the men's classic and the men's physique and this.
Right.
I mean, come on.
Women's figure, women's bikini, women's physique, women's bodybuilding. It's just
and then the women's wellness.
Yeah, wellness, yeah.
I want to, you know, that's another thing, you know. What the hell is women's wellness mean? I mean, I was watching the Olympia, you know, I was watching the Olympia, you know, the last one that they just had.
Yeah.
And women came out and they looked fantastic. Don't get me wrong. But I didn't see much difference between them and the women's, let's say, physique, or I can't, maybe I get confused. To me, they look like the same bodies.
Yeah. So,
all in great shape. I mean, no body fat, beautiful women. Don't get me wrong. They even pose the same.
Yeah.
So I tried to figure out what exactly constitutes women's wellness versus, let's say, women's physique. What makes the difference? I don't know. Do you?
Well, I think it started in South America, like Brazil and places like that. They had a lot of these women with the bigger butts. And they were looking for a division, so they kind of created a division for those women. But it seems like it's getting kind of controversial because it looks like it's not a natural butt. You know, it's not real because they're extremely lean and ripped, and they have these gigantic glutes, these gigantic butts, and that's impossible.
Now that you mention that, I do remember somebody commenting, one of the commentators.
Yeah.
Saying something about, you know, this women's wellness is judged largely on their glutes.
Yeah.
That's how they expressed it. And I'm thinking, wow, we've come to the point.
Yeah.
And sure enough, like you say, as soon as he said that, I started looking a little more carefully. Not that I totally ignore stuff like that, but I started looking a little more carefully. And sure enough, these women had these extraordinary glutes.
Yeah.
I mean, a couple of them looked like they had glute implants.
They
turned to the side. It came out like it reminds me of a statement that Vince Guarando once made. He was talking about this guy in the Vince's gym who had a big butt. He said, I was sitting with Vince in the front of the gym. Vince looks at the guy. He says, that guy has his butt is so big, you can hide a small child under it in the rain and the kid wouldn't get wet. And I was thinking about that when I was looking. I said, my God, gee, what do these girls do? What do they do? Like lunges all day long? I mean, come on.
Yeah. What throws it off, though, I think, is they're so lean. They're so ripped.
Yeah.
They don't lose anything in their butt. I mean, that's impossible.
Not possible. No.
No.
If a woman, let's say a natural woman, when I say natural, I mean no drugs, no antiestrogens. If she diets enough to get down to, let's say, a normal woman's body fat, according to the medical text, believe it or not, is about 20-22%.
Okay.
And the man, it's 15%.
Right.
That's normal body fat. That doesn't mean you're cut up or anything. That means that you don't have a lot of external fat. You look fairly lean, but you don't have much definition.
Yeah.
The reason a woman has more body fat than a man is she has more of what they call essential body fat that's related to biological function. In the case of a woman, it's the breast fat and the fat that's found in the hips, glutes, and upper thigh, right?
Yeah.
So thing is, though, my point being, if a woman goes below a certain percentage of body fat, usually it's let me give you this. If a woman is 11% body fat or lower, the first thing that happens is her menstrual functions turn off. She stops all menstrual functions because the brain interprets that low body fat as a starvation situation. Mm-hmm. And the body, it's almost like a computer. The body will not let that woman get pregnant if she's in a starvation state.
Right.
Now, here's the point, that if she gets even leaner, let's say 8% or less, then all even the essential fat starts disappearing. What does that mean in practical terms? The breasts start to shrink almost to nothing. The fat around the glutes, because, you know, women, they complain about this all the time, about having fat on the glutes and their upper thigh. Mm-hmm. That starts to disappear. So your point, I'm basically underscoring what you're saying, because a woman, like pertaining to the wellness women, they can't be that lean when they have these abs and no special body fat, and they have these huge glutes. It just doesn't go together. You know what I mean?
No.
You know, it's like when you see the women that are real lean, and this pertains to female body, you know, their breasts disappear, whether it's because they use steroids or anti-estrogen, the breasts disappear. So what they do is they put in implants, see? Breast implants. The problem with that is breast implants were designed for women with normal body fat, because the normal body fat obscures the edges of the implant. Oh,
yeah.
When a woman is lean, there's no body fat to obscure it. So some of these women, it looks like two eggs sitting on their chest.
Right. I've seen that.
You know what I'm saying? It's really what you're looking at is the pure breast implant.
Right.
Or breast implant.
Right.
So, you know, but in other words, without those implants, these girls would be flat as a board. You know what I mean?
That's how the 1980 women's bodybuilders were. Remember when it first started?
Sure. And before any women start to attack me as being a male chauvinist or a misogynist, let me just point out, I fully understand why women do that. I'm not trying to put them down. I know it's for cosmetic purposes. And I know that, you know, the way society is today, if a woman doesn't have breasts, you know, a lot of people will kind of look down on her like she's not a real woman. So I understand why the women give the implant. I'm just pointing out, you know, in the relation to these wellness girls, you know, they have these breasts and they have the huge butts, and the rest of them is lean as hell.
Yeah.
They just go together. I mean, you know, to call that wellness is not really the right term.
Right. And I'm not saying all wellness competitors have implants in their butts, because I've seen some that they just do a lot of glutes and they do a lot of those hip thrust and lunges and stuff. Yeah. And they've got well-developed glutes, but I'm just saying it's just, I mean, some of them are so big, you could see their butts from the front.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
It sticks out so hot, so far out on the side, you could see it from the front.
You know who showed a lot? The girls from Brazil. You notice a lot of them were from Brazil?
Yeah.
Now, in Brazil, the butt or the glutes are a big thing for all women.
Yeah.
Where, you know, the glute implants that the plastic surgeons like to peddle on women, that originated in Brazil.
Brazil, because right.
Brazil, you know, I remember Louis Freitas, a bodybuilder years ago?
Yeah.
He won the universe. I remember him telling me he was from Brazil. And I remember him telling me, I said, how were the women down there? He says, well, let me put it this way. When you go to the beach, they wear, he called it dental floss bikinis. I said, what is that, Louis? He says it's basically just a string that goes down their butt.
Yeah.
So if you see them from a distance, it looks like they're naked. And so I remember saying, well, I certainly hope that becomes popular in the United States.
And now you got your wish.
Yeah, you know, and it did. But the point being, there's always been a big emphasis on glutes in women in Brazil. They love it. It's like they're fanatical about it.
Yeah.
So you see these girls in the wellness show, a lot of them, you know, I noticed, I saw it, because the guy would say where they're from. I started to notice a pattern. The girls,
they're
the ones that had the butt, like you said, where it was so big you could see it even when they're standing from the front.
Yeah,
that's how huge it was. You know,
I mean, I think like four of the top five at the Olympia this year were from Brazil.
But here's what I think about. Another thing I think about when I saw that, John, was, I don't know if you remember, there was a controversy years ago. You'll probably remember. You're into the history. Do you remember when the female, this is female bodybuilding, they didn't have all this fitness and all this crap. They only had the hardcore female body. They were doing this pose where they would turn their back to the audience and bend over and like touch their toes.
Yeah, the moon pose.
The moon pose, they called it. And Ben Weider threw a fit over that.
Yeah.
He thought it was lewd and lascivious. And he actually banned it in female. Now, the girls, if you speak to them like I did, they weren't trying to, like, you know, titillate the audience. That's not the purpose. They were trying to show that they were so muscular that they, you could see the striations in the glute, and they were just trying to show the muscularity. They weren't, they, that's the only motive, right? But Ben Weider looked at that, he turned it into a sexual context.
Yeah.
And he thought it would, like, diminish the prestige of the contest. So he banned it. Any girl did that had points taken off and maybe even thrown out of the contest. You know, I don't think. But the point being, when I look at the wellness girls, you know, I don't know if you remember, a lot of their poses would emphasize, I mean, they would literally stick their butt in the air when they turned to the back.
The bikini girls do that too.
Yeah. And I'm thinking, imagine if Ben Weider was still alive.
That's what I was thinking. I wonder if he was around when the bikini girls were doing that. But I guess he wasn't.
No, he wasn't. He was already died. But I'm thinking, imagine if he was alive, what he would think of that.
Yeah.
I guarantee you that stuff would be gone. It never would. It would be gone.
Yeah.
Because he was a little bit of a prude like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He would never go for that. Never.
They banned it for the men, too.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but you know, the funny thing is, and I think you'll agree with this, it was never done as a lewd thing, or, you know, I'm going to, you know, I'm mooning you. It wasn't. Right. That was never the purpose.
Right.
I mean, whether you're a man or a woman, I think you'll agree with this. I mean, it's triply hard for a woman, but whether you're a man or a woman, it's not that easy to get striations in your glute.
Right.
I mean, you have to be really lean and low body fat, no matter who you are.
I think they're doing it to show their hamstrings too.
Yeah, exactly. They're showing the hamstrings also.
Because I think Tom Platz did it before, or maybe he just was doing it in Flex magazine just to show his hamstrings.
He was just doing it in photos.
I think
later on he might have done it in a couple of opposing exhibitions. Wasn't competing.
You know who did do it in his routine was Joe Miko.
Joe Miko, did he do that?
Yeah, he did it. Yeah.
Okay. No, but I mean, my point being here, if you have it and you've worked that hard to develop it, I don't see anything wrong with showing it. Well, you know, why would you consider that lewd or you know, sexual? It's not.
Right.
I remember. Do you remember when Flex magazine for a while? They were coming out with these centerfolds, almost like a girly magazine, where you can open it up and it's like a triple page. And it's female bodybuilders. And Bill Dobbins was specializing in photographing the female bodybuilders. A lot of them were nude photos. So I was on a plane going to the Arnold show once, and I just had the new Flex, and I was reading it. And I opened Dobbins was sitting next to me. And I opened the magazine, pulled out the centerfold. There was a girl there, a lying hunter, named Debbie something or other. I can't remember. You might remember Debbie something or other. And she was lying on her side completely nude. And, you know, her ass was about as cut. I mean, it didn't look like a woman's behind, you know.
Yeah.
I said to Dobbins, I said, Bill, I said, no offense to you or this woman, but that doesn't even look like a woman's behind. He says, and he said to me, that's the way it's supposed to look. I mean, it was pure muscle. There was really nothing sexual about it.
Right.
It was so muscular that you don't even think about it being a naked behind. All you saw was literally striations.
Right.
That's it.
You supposed know? To be a little softer.
Exactly. Yeah, and it would look like hard as a rock. It looked like if you touched it, you'd break your hand. I mean, seriously. Yeah.
Man, it's amazing when you look at the women bodybuilders from the 80s. And like we were just talking about Mario Saline from Hawaii, because I was just out there. Yeah. And I saw her when I was in the late 80s. I think we had about maybe 6 or 7 MPC shows in Chicago where I lived. And I got involved in judging, and I would be judging every show. Sometimes I was even the head judge, the guy that called out the posters and stuff.
Yeah.
And Mario, and they had guest posers all the time at all the shows. They always had a guest poser. Sure. So Mario came out and she was guest posing at a show, and I was absolutely blown away, Jerry, by her beauty. I mean, it was like, I can't remember what pose she was posing to, a slow song, and it was so beautifully done. I remember, like, I was watching it with my mouth open, and when it ended, I turned around to everybody who was sitting around me. I said, that's one of the best routines I've ever seen. I mean, she was just, that's the way women's bodybuilding was originated, and that's the way it's supposed to be. It was mesmerizing. It was sensual. It was beautiful. It was creative. I wish I could have recorded that. It was just incredible. Yeah.
You know what that reminds you of, that story, John? When I was working for Weider, they had the, remember the Grand Prix Tour, Pro Tours in Europe?
Yeah.
In 87, I won a Grand Prix. There was a contest held at Essen, Germany.
Yeah.
And the guest poser at that show was Anja Langer. Do you remember
her? Yeah.
You know, I had seen her in the magazine, but I never saw her in person. They announced her, and now, you know, it was, I don't know whether it was German or English, I don't remember, but she came out from the side of the stage. They were playing the music from that movie, The Pink Pussycat. I don't know if you remember the theme song.
Pink Panther, right?
Pink Panther. Pink Panther, that's right. Yeah. I'm sorry. Pink Panther, right. I don't want to get pussy. Pink Panther.
I remember that routine, yeah.
Yeah, she strode across very sensually. And the way she posed, I mean, the audience was in dead silence.
Yeah.
I mean, I looked around at all the guys that were like, just like you said, everybody was like,
yeah, yeah.
She looked like so beautiful.
Yeah.
And the way she posed was so sensuous. And she had a great body, a little tiny waist.
Yeah.
And she had abs. She very feminine, but she posed so beautifully, so sensually. It was more sexual, but not sexual at the same time.
Yeah.
I mean, and I still remember that to this day, you know?
Yeah.
I never actually met her. I just saw her pose. I never spoke to her, though.
You know, when I was at Mario Saline's gym in Maui, her son works there as a trainer. Anja Langer's son.
Oh, is that right? Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's got to be, what, close to 60? Or?
Yeah, I would say 60, yeah.
Have to be, yeah, because that was in 87 that I saw her.
Yeah, I think Mario's in her 60s, so I'm sure she is too. Yeah,
I saw a recent somebody posted a picture. I don't know if you saw that, a group photo of a couple of German bodybuilders.
Yeah, I did see that. Yeah,
Anja was there. She still looks great.
Looks great. Yeah,
I mean, she wasn't in a bikini or anything, but I mean, her face in the photo doesn't look that much different than what I saw in 87.
I contacted her. I tried to get her to appear on my show. Do an interview, and she said she does absolutely no interviews.
No interview. Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah, nobody's ever interviewed.
Yeah,
it's weird. Like, isn't that kind of strange?
I know.
But some of these people, you would think they want to, like, just for posterity.
Yeah, exactly.
They put so much effort into competing.
Yeah.
You would think, you know, let's have a record of this. Let's talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, just for no other reason, posterity.
Especially because so many people still remember her from that time.
Yeah.
I mean, she's very well thought of, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Some of them might say, well, I want people to remember me when I was at my best. But the point is, John, you're not going to ask them to strip down and pose. So,
right.
You know, we're just going to interview you. You don't have to worry about posing.
Well, she looks great anyway. So.
And she looks great anyway. So I don't understand how she – I don't understand her thinking there, you know.
Yeah.
I don't get it.
Well, let's talk about some of these NPC shows, the amateur shows from the 1992. Let's go to the Junior Nationals first. Now, back then, Jerry, the Junior Nationals and the Junior USA were both national-level competitions, but they were kind of like proving grounds for how good you could do on the national level before you went to the USA or the Nationals. It was like a stepping stone, right? Yeah. I know I did that, too. When I competed as an amateur, I won state and regional-level shows. And then I went to the Junior Nationals first before I went to the Nationals. So this was a big contest, pretty big contest. They had, they had a bantamweight with 11 competitors, and then there was, well, they only list 15, so there might have been more, but they listed the top 15 in each of the other classes. So they had a lightweight, middleweight, light heavy, and heavy. The overall winner was Ken Castagnoli. I don't know if you remember him.
Vaguely. Yeah, the name vaguely familiar.
Yeah, he did. He competed at the Nationals, too. He got, like, eighth place and fifth place. He took fifth place that year at the Nationals, so he did, well, did pretty good.
If he got fifth, that means I interviewed him, because I used to interview the top six.
Okay.
I honestly don't remember him.
But our friend Dave Lieberman got second in that show.
Oh, Dave. Dave, I know very well. Yeah.
Yeah.
From Cleveland.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lee Apperson, remember him? He was 11.
Yes, I do. Sure. Lee Apperson was, wasn't he in couples posing for a while also? I mean, didn't he do that?
Might have been.
He was on a lot of covers. If
he was on a lot of covers, yeah. He was very lean, always ripped.
Very lean guy, yeah. Yeah.
And the light heavyweights, a guy named Arthur Fickling won the light heavyweights. I remember him. He was pretty good.
Yeah.
Don Long, who went on to win the Nationals a couple years later, was fifth in the light heavyweights. So he was just getting started.
Yeah. Yeah, nice guy, Don Long. I remember him, yeah.
Robert Mello won the middleweights.
Hmm.
I remember the show was covered on ESPN, too.
Was it?
ESPN was covering these shows back then.
Okay. Yeah, that's right.
And Johnny Stewart, who also went on to do really well on the national level, he won the middleweights. Or the lightweights, I'm sorry, the lightweights.
Johnny Stewart, is that the guy who had the great calves?
Or am I? No, that was Roger Stewart.
Oh, Roger Stewart, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So let me just see who won the Junior USA. The Junior USA, I never heard of this guy, Bruce West.
Never heard of him either.
And Vinny Galante won the middleweights.
Vinny's still around.
Yeah, he's still competing.
He's actually still competing in great shape, Vinny.
Yeah, he's doing the Masters, right?
Yeah, nice guy. Yeah, very nice guy from New Jersey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about a big one. That was the USA, and I'm sure you were at this one, Jerry. Flex Wheeler was the overall winner. So
yeah.
Flex had been competing on the national level for several years, and he was getting better and better every year. So in 1991, the year before, he took second at the Nationals to Kevin Livroni, and he was also second in the USA to Mike Lombroso. And so this was 1 year later, and he was so much improved. I remember I was blown away. I think everybody was blown away by how amazing he looked at the show.
I knew Flex. We became friends pretty fast, you know?
Yeah.
And I interviewed him right after he won the USA. So I said, the USA, correct me if I'm wrong, when you won the USA, you got a pro card, right?
Yeah, it started in 87. So right. You had to win the overall, not just your class, but you had to win the overall.
So I taking that into account, I interviewed Flex. And I said, well, what's your plans now? I mean, you could go right in. Listen, Flex, you can go right into the pro ranks. And, man,
absolutely.
You would be, let me tell you, if you could win the Olympia, you would be an immediate threat, right? You know what he said to me? He said, I don't know if I could do that. I don't think I can compete against those pro guys.
Wow.
I said, the only other guy who said that to me was Vince Taylor. Vince Taylor said to me when I first met him, it was actually in Germany. Before, I looked at him. I'd never heard of this guy, and he brought photos of him, and he had these huge calves. You know what he looked like? He had the big calf, the great, fantastic arm. I said, my God, you're not an amateur. You're a pro bodybuilder, for crying out loud. He said, no. He says, those guys would blow me. I said, listen, I don't know what's wrong with you. Believe me, I know these guys. You would easily compete. You would beat most of them. And
of course,
happened. He wound up winning, 50 pro shows or something?
Right.
But the thing is, I remember he was very, not that confident, Flex.
Yeah.
I couldn't understand why, because he had, what a genetic freak. I mean, I remember he showed me a photo. He was like, he started this skinny little guy. I mean, just bone thin.
Yeah.
And, he has that, we talked about this before, how a lot of the top successful bodybuilders, John, they start out very skinny, but that's an advantage because they have very small hips, they have small joints, and if they build muscle on top of that, they get this unbelievable build where they get the widest shoulders, the tiny waist,
yeah,
the wide lats. it's actually an advantage almost to start like that. And
yeah.
He was those guys. He just built muscle and on muscle. And, you know, he competed in martial arts too, you know. I mean,
yeah.
I think he, I don't know whether he was a cop or he wanted to be a cop. I remember him telling me something.
Yeah, I remember that too.
Fresno, I can't remember where.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, but I still remember how he was kind of not so sure about being that successful.
When you see how he looked in that show, that's unbelievable, because that's probably one of the best conditions he ever had in his whole career.
That's true.
In that 92 of USA, yeah.
Yeah. Right after that, though, his attitude started to change.
Yeah.
Where he started to get a lot more, almost to the point of where he's accused of being cocky, which is amazing.
Yeah, right.
Because if you knew the guy, like I did, he really wasn't as cocky. He presented that, and he explained to me why, because it reminded me of what Arnold did years ago. The cocky attitude he presented was to cover up his true nature, which was actually introverted and almost shy and not confident. So he acted like he was overconfident, so he would, you know, come off better.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, people took it to be arrogant and cocky, but that's not the way he really was.
Yeah.
Now, Arnold, when he first came over this country, he was speaking broken English, and he was very self-conscious. Like, I think I told you the story. Anyone in the original Gold's Gym, if you were at the other end of the gym and laughed, let's say somebody told you a joke, Arnold would turn around, look at you sharply. He thought you were laughing at him.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to explain, Arnold, they're not laughing at you, you know. So then he started to do something. I watched him do this. He started to acquire a persona that was the opposite of the way he was. He started to be super confident, overconfident. I mean, it got to the point where he was seeming like cocky. And eventually, in Arnold's case, he became what he was acting as.
Yeah.
So in psychology, they tell you if you start to act a certain way, even if that's not your true personality, eventually it will become your true personality.
Yeah, yeah.
This is what happened with Arnold.
Yeah.
Because when he first showed up, he was almost like Flex and Vince Dale. He was not quite as assured of himself as you would think.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy had already accomplished tremendous. I mean, Mr. Universe at what, 20, 21 years old?
20, he, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, one of the best bodybuilders in the world, but he still wasn't sure of himself, you know.
So that's amazing.
Made believe he was.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we didn't have the internet back then, but I just remember just from the way people were talking, and I don't know if you heard this at the gyms or whatever, but it was like everybody was blown away by Flex Wheeler that year. It was just, he was so amazing.
Yeah. Well, remember his back? He had that back.
The detail in his back.
Every inch of his back had muscle definition.
He was like a perfect bodybuilder. I mean, like you said, he could have went right into a pro show and defeated almost anybody.
Yeah. He had full muscle bellies in his arms. I mean, the guy had everything.
Yeah.
He was literally unbeatable. I mean, and he was a pretty good poser, too.
Yeah.
Another guy who was influenced by what I call the John Brown school of posing.
Yeah.
You know, he tried to do that, like Sean Ray, the fancy stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And he did the splits.
I was just going to say,
yeah,
he showed off his martial arts skills, but, you know, that always got the audience nuts. I remember when he did it in his USA routine. He went into a double bicep, and then slowly he went down to the split.
Yeah.
And the audience went nuts.
Yeah.
Let's say there was somebody attending that contest who never attended a bodybuilding show and had heard the old story about bodybuilding being stiff and they can't move.
Yeah.
This guy on stage doing a split,
right,
which I've never been able to do. I wouldn't.
No, me neither.
And it scares me to even think about it.
Right.
And this guy did it, and he actually went back up slowly. You know what I mean? I mean, amazing. He had everything.
Yeah, he was good the year before when he took second to Lavroni and to Mike Matarazzo, but he was bigger, like much bigger in 92, I think. And he still had that same amount of cuts and symmetry and everything else.
Yeah, he put on a lot of size in that one year. That's very true.
Yeah, yeah. And then he pretty much looked like this next year when he went into the Arnold, and he won the Arnold and the Ironman, and he beat like Flex, or he beat Lee Labrada, he beat Vince Taylor, he beat Paul Dillette, he beat pretty much almost the top guys in pro bodybuilding, you know.
True. He was just about unbeatable in that.
Yeah, he really was.
I mean, he just had everything. What are you going to do about that? You can't, how do you beat a guy like that? Little tiny waist, I mean, geez.
But that just goes to show you, I think, Jerry, when you don't give out those pro cards that much, and a guy like him has to work his way up. It literally took him years before he got that pro card, because he was competing at the national level, I think, since 89.
Yeah.
So this was like, you know, and he made significant improvement every year. And, you know, he was hungry, but that's what happens when you keep denying him. He keeps getting better and better and better until eventually he's like one of the best in the world.
Well, I think the old system that existed when Flex was competing, where they had fewer actual pros with pro cards, led to a greater degree of quality.
Absolutely.
When the pros did compete, let's say in the Olympia, every guy was very high quality. I mean, it was just, you know, you had to be just to get to that level.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying it's much worse today, but my point being that a lot of the guys who have pro cards, regardless, will never get to the Olympia level.
No.
They, for whatever reason, whether it's genetics, whatever, you know, they're never going to be pros. You know, I'm talking about elite pros.
Yeah.
The Olympics. It's never going to happen for these guys.
What I see now is when these guys turn pro, they take off a year or two just to build their physique up because they're not at that level yet. Where when you only gave out like one or a couple pro cards a year, those guys were seasoned by the time they made it to the pros, and they were ready for the pros because they had gone through, like Flex had, so many years of keeping improving in order to make it, you know, in order to win, you know.
That's true. It's almost like a bodybuilding apprenticeship, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Which is the way it should be.
It should. I totally agree.
Do you remember Chris Duffy? He was second to Flex.
Oh, sure. I knew Chris Duffy well. Crazy guy. Dude.
Crazy, I know.
He used to train at Gold's. When I first met him, he was training at Gold's with a guy, you got to think back, a guy named James DeMello. Do you remember James?
Oh, yeah. I competed with James DeMello.
James DeMello. Do you remember his calves?
Yeah. Like 21-inch calves.
This guy had calves like, you know, I mean, just one of the freakiest calves I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't that big, the rest of his body, but his calves were like just ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I got to know both of those guys. And I asked James DeMello one time, I said, were you born with those calves? So he says, no. And right away, I was skeptical. I said,
yeah,
no, you don't get calves like that.
No.
So you know what he said to me? I said, well, then what's your secret? He says, let me put it this way, Jared. When I train my calves, I continue my set way past the point where most people stop. You know, how you do a set, let's say 20 reps, you get the deep muscle burn, where you're just excruciating pain, you have to stop.
Yeah.
And he went on to explain, I go reps past that. Mm. I go way past that. He says, it's something I've developed. I have this huge resistance to pain. That's what gave me the calves.
Hmm.
To be honest with you, I don't buy that.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't give a crap how much pain resistance you have.
His upper body didn't look like that.
Yeah, no, his upper body was fairly mediocre. It was a good body, you know, not a pro level body, but his calves, none of the pros at the time could match his calves.
No, I remember, yeah.
And his calves were genetic. He became a very religious guy later on, you know, body stuff and all that. But as far as Duffy goes, Duffy was always a kind of a bit of an eccentric guy, you know, strange guy, tall guy, good build, you know. He surprised me how good a shape he got in. Because when he was training with DeMello, he looked like a big football player.
He used to bulk up a lot in the offseason.
Yeah, he used to bulk up. He was a big guy, but he didn't look like he had a pro-quality physique. But later on, he refined, and you know, as you know, he did become a pro, you know.
Yeah, really good legs.
He had very good legs.
Yeah.
Yeah, he did. He did. He had very good legs. That's true.
And he was real strong, right? Real strong squatter.
Very strong. Today he lives, I think, in Florida, if I remember correctly.
I met him when I first moved here to Tampa.
Did you?
Yeah, he was training at my gym at Powerhouse.
I saw a photo, you know, not a physique. It was just a facial photo on his Facebook page. And again, I had the same reaction. I had to rub my eyes because I knew him, Duffy. He had like, you know, thick, dark hair. You know, he had a certain look. The person in the photo had a gray beard and was bald.
Yeah.
But even the face did not look like the Duffy that I knew. I said, no, this isn't Chris Duffy. But I guess it was completely different appearance.
I believe he got AIDS.
Yes, I heard that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He was doing, he got into doing porno films, gay porno films.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, unfortunately, that was the era where AIDS was going around pretty bad. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I first met him in 92 or 93, it was right after this because this was 92. So I was doing a guest posing in Tennessee and he was there. And I think he had just started getting into that porno stuff.
Yeah. He was married originally to a girl named Marianne. Marianne. At the time, she was Marianne Duffy. She's still around. You know, I never see her because she trains through there. She's a very nice lady.
Wasn't he with Joanne Starkey or something?
That's what happened was he dumped Marianne for this Joanne, who was a hardcore female bodybuilder.
Right.
I mean, the big delts and stuff.
Yeah.
Nice woman if you talk to her. I mean,
yeah, I met her.
Very nice person, you know, but he dumped, Marianne for her, you know, and
Marianne, I remember Marianne Duffy. I remember her when she competed.
She remarried. She's very happy, you know, and this very nice person. We have the same political views. Sometimes we sit and complain about the anti-vaxxers and all this kind of crap.
Yeah. But,
she whatever you call it, she said to me a couple of years later when I did see her, she says, one of the best things in my life was when Chris left me. He says, you know, it really was a great turning point for me. She says, not bitter about it at all. She's very happy about it.
Yeah.
She's a very nice woman. Yeah.
Well, third place was Mike Francois, who went on to become an Arnold Classic winner, a great pro bodybuilder.
Did he win the Arnold Classic that year?
No, not till 95. He wasn't even a pro yet.
Okay. Because when he won the Arnold Classic,
I think he turned pro the next year, 93.
Okay. When he won the Arnold Classic, his coach was Chris Aceto.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And he was sitting backstage, and, you know, it was pretty obvious that year. He was in unbelievable shape. Everybody knew he was going to win the Arnold contest.
Actually, he beat Flex at that show.
Right. Yes. And it turned out that happened to be his birthday.
Yeah, March 4th.
So I went up to him backstage. Chris was sitting right next to him. This is Mike Francois. And I leaned over to him. I said, "Hey, Mike," I said, "we just found out that today's your birthday." So he didn't answer me. He just looked at me. I said, "So what we're going to do for you is we're going to go have, when you go out to pose, the whole audience is going to stand up and sing happy birthday to you." When I said that, Chris laughed, but Mike Francois just glared at me. He didn't say a word. He just like he was giving me the subliminal message. Don't even
think do it. Right.
And I walked away. You know, he didn't seem to me. I mean, he's probably a nice guy. He didn't seem a very friendly guy. You know, maybe because he was, you know, dieting and tired.
Oh yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
I never held anything against him. Later on, of course, he got that severe intestinal problem that
colitis.
Yeah, that destroyed his bodybuilding career. You know.
All right, the light heavyweight class was won by John Sherman, John the Tank Sherman. Remember him?
John the Tank Sherman, sure.
Yeah.
He from Georgia or something like that?
Yeah, I think Atlanta, yeah.
Yeah, Atlanta, yeah. I spoke to him also. He was a very nice guy. He told me a couple of interesting things about his training, but I wish I could remember. I don't remember what it was, but he had a couple of unique ideas about training.
Mm-hmm.
He was a short guy, but very thick.
Very thick. Real good legs, I remember.
Very good legs, yeah. Nice guy.
You look like a guy who trained heavy.
Yeah. I think that's what he said. He was into very heavy training, if I remember.
Yeah.
Like heavy weights. Yeah.
I think even Flex was impressed with him, you know, because they posed down together in the pose down. So.
Yeah. No, he was good, Sherman.
Let's see any other big names. You remember Joe Tricoli? He won the lightweight class.
No, I don't remember that guy. I'm sure I interviewed him. I just don't remember that guy.
I don't know where he's from, but he was really ripped. I remember he had a real good look.
Yeah.
But a big show. I mean, they had 12 bantamweights, 14 lightweights, 14 middleweights, 15 light heavies, and 18 heavyweights. So.
Oh, yeah, that was a big show.
But that was obviously all Flex. I mean, I think that was the highlight of that year was him winning.
Yeah, he was a clear winner.
Yeah.
The closest guy. Yeah, the closest guy would be Sherman to him, who gave him the most competition in that show.
So then at the Nationals, a couple months later in the fall, John Sherman did win. He won the overall. He won the light heavyweights and overall.
Right.
And Chris Duffy won the heavyweights. So they both got their pro card at that show.
That's right, yeah.
Edgar Fletcher was third in the heavyweights.
Now, that's an interesting guy, Edgar Fletcher.
Yeah.
This guy had a tremendous physique. He had, like, you know, huge lats, small waist.
Small waist.
Tremendous genetic advantage. Great arms, and yet nothing ever happened to the guy. He kind of faded out.
Never turned pro, yeah.
He's one of those guys that said one of the guys that should have been a pro but never did, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he really had a pro body, that guy.
Yeah. I heard from somebody that knew him that he would cheat on his diet a lot. When he got close to the show, he'd just kind of blow it, you know?
Really?
Yeah.
I don't remember him being out of shape. Maybe it's true.
No, I don't remember either. I mean, from the pictures I've seen of him, he always looked good.
Yeah, I don't remember him looking bad at any contest.
Like you said, he had that small waist and that great back, and his front double bicep was amazing.
Yeah, his bicep, the arms were tremendous.
Yeah. And then Paul DeMeo was fourth that year.
Oh, Quadzilla, the guy with the legs. Paul, poor Paul. You know, the guy had a tragic end to his life, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
From Massachusetts, nice guy, really super nice guy. Got into what happened with him. There was a fad around that time in bodybuilding, where, including a lot of the pros, were taking a drug called Nubane.
Mm-hmm.
Nubane was supposed to be a pain or analgesic drug.
Yeah.
They were taking it because two reasons. Supposedly, it would kind of relieve if you had joint pain, like shoulder, elbow pain. But more importantly, it decreased the pain you felt when you trained. So theoretically, you could train harder.
Through the pain.
Now, here's where they went wrong. The idea of Nubane was a narcotic, but it was thought that it did, you know, you have what they call opiate receptors in the brain.
Yeah.
They thought that Nubane didn't react with the same receptors that, let's say, opiate drugs like morphine and opium, interact with. So, in other words, the point is it was non-addicting. That's what the bodybuilders were told. It was non-addicting. That turned out to be false.
Mm.
Who gave them that information? I think it was, unfortunately, Dan Duchesne who spread that around. It was not true because it turns out that Nubane did have an overlapping effect where it did interact with opiate receptors. So it was addictive. And even worse, some of the guys Gary Stranum became addicted to it.
Oh, really?
He had to go into rehab because of it.
Oh, wow.
And as far as Paul, unfortunately, Paul, he went on to harder drugs like heroin. And he was back in Massachusetts. He did some crazy things on the drugs. He took a gun. He started shooting it in the air. And his girlfriend got arrested or something like that. And then what happened with Paul, he bought some street heroin that was unfortunately tainted with a type of a poison, black tar. I can't remember what it was called, but basically killed him.
Wow.
You know, in other words, he took a form of a street opium that was poisonous.
Mm.
And young guy, I think he was in his maybe early, mid-30s, killed him. That's what happened to him, Paul.
Wow.
But he had tremendous leg development. I mean,
incredible.
Maybe not as good as Platt's, but certainly very impressive legs.
Yeah. Well, they called him Quadzilla.
Yeah, they called him Quadzilla. And he was just the nicest guy to talk to. We used to talk all the time.
Mm.
Great guy. Very, very nice guy.
Probably died pretty young, too.
Very young, like maybe 32. I felt terrible when I felt terrible when I heard that because he was such a – it was so sad that this guy drifted into the drugs, you know?
Yeah.
All started with that new – it affected – quite a few other guys still got in trouble using that crap.
Yeah, I heard he died of heroin. I didn't know how he got involved with that. So that makes sense because I remember a lot of those bodybuilders were taking Nubane, especially the guys on the West Coast.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of them were. I mean, there's a lot of other names. I won't mention them, but a lot of the top pros, let's put it that way. And, you know, they would get – this is an example of being careful who you get information from.
Yeah.
So the gurus, you know, we've talked about in the past – you know, it could, in this case, prove fatal or mess up your whole life.
Yeah.
You know, these guys believed the guy who told them that it was non-addicting, it would kill the pain, help them sleep, and make help them train harder. And, you know, yes, it did all those things, but it also was addicting.
Yeah.
And in many cases, some of the guys, it was what they call a gateway drug, where some of the guys went on, like Paul, went on to take really bad drugs like heroin.
Yeah.
And that's where the danger was.
Reminds me of like that fentanyl that was going around, you know, when people started taking that, it was laced with, you know, it was killing people right and left, dude.
I mean, there's a lot of people today who call marijuana a gateway drug. No, they're just saying that if you take marijuana, this is the theory. If you take marijuana, you're going to want to take other drugs that make you even higher.
Right.
Cocaine and heroin or whatever, fentanyl, you know, which is just bullshit. I mean, you know, there's plenty of people that, I mean, for crying out loud, it's legal in most
places. Everybody's smoking marijuana now, yeah.
There's plenty of people that take marijuana, you know, in any form, whether it's cannabis or, you know, CBD or marijuana. They don't go on to take heroin or fentanyl. That's complete horseshit, you know?
Right.
And even, you know, I've seen articles in medical journals where some of these clown researchers, I call them, even say that about steroids. Seriously, this is the thinking. If you use, if you're an athlete who uses anabolic steroids, you're going to go on to use heroin and hard drugs.
Oh, jeez.
They never list the mechanism or any way that it's connected. They just spout it out like, I'm warning you, use the steroids and you'll be a heroin. Oh, bullshit. These guys are so full of crap, you know?
Steroids don't get you high.
Yeah, right? Gateway drug.
Well, Ken Castagnoli, who won the junior nationals, like I said, he ended up fifth. Dean Caputo, remember Dean Caputo? He was seventh.
Yeah. Remind me, wasn't he from the Midwest somewhere?
Ohio, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I spoke to Dean. Was a nice guy. Came out to Gold's Club. Big guy.
Real big chest, yeah.
Yeah, he had a really big frame, one of those really big bone guys. That can, you know, it can hold a lot of muscle size.
I believe he's a gym owner. I think he owns a powerhouse gym. He still is in the gym business. He's been it for a long time.
Oh, I'm glad. I hope he's still healthy and everything.
He was good.
Very nice guy. Very nice. Spoke to
him. Yeah, he was.
Great guy. Yeah.
First time I did the junior nationals in 1986, he won the heavyweight class. He won my class.
Right, right.
And DeMillo was third that year.
DeMillo?
Yeah, DeMillo was third, yeah.
Same guy with the Cavs?
In the junior nationals, not in this one.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
He was 21 years old. He got third place in the junior nationals.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I wish I had those Cavs that DeMillo had, boy.
Me too. I remember Lee Haney, at that junior nationals, Lee Haney was guest posing, and we were all like hanging around the lobby before the night show started, and he was walking around with cargo pants that were cut off at the knees to show off his calves.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, when you have calves like that, why hide them? You know,
yeah.
I do the same thing, you know?
I remember Lee Haney was talking to him, and he's like, yeah, you got good potential, you know? He goes, look at those calves.
Yeah. But he was kind of like Chris in a way, Chris Dickerson. Because, you know, remember Chris had exceptional calves too, also genetic. But, you know, Chris's upper body, you know, never really matched his calves. You know what I mean? The calves were out of proportion.
Yeah.
I mean, not that Chris wasn't a great bodybuilder, but, you know, his calves were way out of proportion to the way the rest of his muscles were as far as muscle mass and size, you know?
Yeah.
And I always thought of when I used to look at Chris, I think of this biblical phrase. It's that, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. In other words, the Lord gave Chris these fantastic calves, but didn't allow him to have decent biceps.
Yeah, DeMillo was, everybody was saying he was going to be like the next Bob Paris. They thought for sure he was going to be a pro and, you know.
Right. Geez, if he would have gotten his upper body to the lower body, he would have been very hard to beat, you know.
I heard he had problems just living out in L.A. and, you know, that whole lifestyle. Yeah. And I think that's why he moved back to Louisiana.
He was another guy that had a little bit of psychological problems. Like when I talked to him, I mean, he was already showing signs of a lot of these people. And anyone watching this, don't attack me for what I'm about to say. But some of these people that have a lot of personal problems, they can't deal with it, so they become religious.
You know,
they say, well, God will guide me to what I should do. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that if it makes them feel better. But he was in that category, and so was, of course, it turns out Duffy became like that too. Bob Birdsaw. There's a lot of famous bodybuilders that, you know, whatever, they had guilt complexes, whatever, they had things in their personal life that they were really bothering them. So they kind of like said, well, I'm going to give my self to the Lord. I'm going to read the Bible and this. And he was one of those guys, you know.
Yeah.
And again, that's a personal choice. I'm not trying to put anyone down. If you want to do that, that's fine. You know what I mean? But I'm just saying that he was one of those guys that was like that.
Yeah, I think he went on to compete in natural bodybuilding.
By the way, another guy like that is Rory Liedermeyer, an old
friend. Oh, really? Okay.
Rory is a terrific guy, and he's in his 60s in fantastic shape.
Yeah.
But he's very, very much into religion. Very much into, he's always quoting Bible, the Lord, this, Lord. And, you know, if it makes him happy and, you know, the faith gives him strength, more power to him, I say. He's not hurting anybody. That's my point, you know.
Yeah, DeMillo went on to compete in natural bodybuilding because I think it was this year, 92, I saw a picture of him in Muscle Mag, and he won a natural bodybuilding show. But he was like 185 pounds instead of like the 215. He was 215 when I saw him at that junior national, so he was 30 pounds different, you know.
So do you think he might have used drugs for a while and then got off the drugs and compete as a natural? Is that possible?
Yeah, because like I said, there was a 30-pound difference.
Yeah, that sounds to me. I think you figured out that mystery.
Yeah. I mean, he looked good. I mean, the one picture I saw of him, he was really ripped, but I was like, he was a lot smaller, you know.
Yeah, but he still had the calves, right?
I'm sure, yeah. I'm sure that didn't go away.
So genetic calves are there, you know.
Well, I want to talk about the other pro qualifier in the amateurs, and that was the North American Championships. And like I mentioned, this is an IFBB show. It wasn't an NPC show because it was international, because it featured Mexico, United States, and Canada. And the winner was Paul Dillette from Canada.
Bob, my old friend Paul Dillette, one of the more interesting guys I've met in my years in bodybuilding was Paul.
Yeah.
He won the North America that year, right?
He won the North America in 92, yeah. So it was interesting because he was good friends with Flex Wheeler, and they both won their pro cards that year.
This is when I met him, Paul Dillette.
Yeah.
I met him there, and I interviewed him, and we kind of hit it off. We became friends. When I went to all the pro shows after that, all the Wheeler, whether it was the Olympia or whatever, any pro show that he competed in, we kind of hung out together.
Yeah.
In fact, there's a picture of me on my Facebook page. You know how they have those banquets after the Olympia?
Yeah.
There's a shot of me sitting at a table with Paul and Milo Sarchev and one or two other guys who I can't remember, but Paul's sitting right next to me. We used to hang out at the contests, you know. I remember when they held the Olympia in Atlanta, when Paul competed, after the show, we went to a strip club, I remember. And I still remember because it had like three stories. It was a three-story club. I don't remember the name, but it was him and you know, Danny Hester, who won the original Olympia. It was me, Paul, and Danny Hester, right? We went to the strip club, and I don't know why. I talked about it recently with Danny. I swear to you, I didn't smoke any pot. I wasn't on any drugs. But as soon as I went in that place, I couldn't stop giggling. I was just because what I saw, they had these women dancing, and they had these guys sitting like on a stool, like, you know, you'd walk by, and the guys are sitting on the stool, these fat guys, and, you know, little fat bald guys, and they have these gorgeous strippers, you know, doing these sexy moves in front of, and the guys would be like drooling and stuff, and, you know, sweating. And I don't know what, for some reason, I that struck me as hilarious. So Paul said, let's go in a private room. So I'm thinking, well, what's going to happen in a private room? I said, what's a private room? He said, a girl comes in and dances only for us. All right, so we go in this room, the small room, and it was me, Paul, and Danny Hester. And about 5 minutes later, this girl comes. I still remember she was wearing a look like an American flag bikini, you know, stars and stripes and stuff. Yeah. So I said, oh, you're patriotic. Good to see you. You know, but in the meantime, I was still laughing, right? So, you know, she's starting to, you know, she was a gorgeous woman. And my God, her body was, it was just incredible. I can't even, you know, she made the Playboy bunnies look terrible. She was fantastic. She had a beautiful face. She starts the gyrations and the dancing. And I'm looking at Paul, and he's like this, his eyes. Danny's just, you know, Danny's more a little laid back. He's relaxed. In the meantime, I'm still laughing. I just could not stop giggling.
Yeah.
And the girl finally turns to me. She says, "Is what I'm doing this funny?" So I said to her, "Listen, honey, it's not you. It has nothing that you're a very beautiful woman." I said, "I just, and I'm in this kind of crazy mood. I can't stop laughing. I'm not laughing at you. Trust me, I'm not laughing." I still remember that story. It was funny as hell.
You know? Yeah, well, Paul was in the magazines a lot back then, remember? Because he got second at the show a year ago to Ray McNeil.
Ray McNeil, the man. Yeah. Oh, my God, what a horrible event.
Yeah.
In fact, at the one of the Atlanta Olympics, at the Atlanta Olympias, I sat and had lunch with Paul and Ray McNeil. It was it was two us three, and that's when Paul, you know, leaned over to me, and he said, "Jerry," he goes like this. Ray was sitting right there. He says, "I didn't know Ray was a womanizer until later, but he, you know, but
yeah."
Paul leans over and says, "He says, Jerry." Because we're all staying in the same hotel in Atlanta. Paul says, "Jerry, I have two women here, and I have my girlfriend also." And he says if the girl, one of the girls from Germany, dark hair, if she comes down and sits with us, and my girlfriend comes in the restaurant, say that she's your girlfriend.
Yeah.
So I agreed to it. Luckily, the German girl never showed up. I never had to play that role. But it's funny because Paul had three women in the hotel's girlfriends.
Yeah, he had a lot of girlfriends. He had a lot of women.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
You would think being that big, he'd be intimidating, but I guess a lot of women like that.
Oh, they liked him. I mean, he was basically a nice guy.
He was.
He was like almost like a little kid sometimes, he reminded me of.
Yeah.
He was like just a really... I mean, I was a little surprised to see that Paul went on to go back to Canada, where he's from, and start a very successful bodybuilding federation.
Yeah, the WBBF.
And he's trimmed down. He's all the way down, you know.
Yeah.
And I saw some recently. He looks good. He looks healthy. I mean, he has a child. He married a woman up there. He has a girl. I guess she's probably 12 or 13. I don't know how old she is now.
Yeah.
You know, I spoke to him on the phone one time. I should call him. I haven't called him in a while. You know, we spoke for a while, and he was doing great. I'm happy for the guy, you know?
Yeah, I'd like to interview him for my show if I ever get a chance.
Oh, he's a nice guy, and I'll tell you, I'm going to say this, John. This might surprise you, but, you know, I've seen many of the great bodybuilders over the years in their prime, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Sergio Oliva, and I'm telling you that up close, like right in front of you, Paul Dillette was the most massive bodybuilder I've ever seen, bar none, including Arnold, including Sergio. Because one of the Olympians, he called me to the room. He was wanted me to check out his posing routine. That girlfriend was there too. And I remember he flexed his arm like this. And it was, I just couldn't believe the size of it.
Yeah.
It looked like he had a football underneath there. It looked like the size of a football. Just imagine.
Yeah.
Bicep. And his forearms, everything, his pecs. And he had a small waist for a big man.
I know. And huge legs.
And his calves were huge.
Huge, yeah.
I said to him, "Paul, that's genetic. Those calves are genetic." He says, no. He said, "I'll show you a photo." He shows me a photo of him when he first started. He was skinny, just like I said, the other guy. Here we go again, a skinny guy.
Yeah.
And he showed me a photo with shorts, and he had big calves. I said, "Paul, how long were you training when this picture was taken?" He said, "I hadn't started yet." I said, "Look at the calves." I said, "How can you tell me you don't have natural?" And he laughed. He says, "Yeah, I guess I do."
Yeah.
He was a great guy.
He was such a freak. It seemed like he got big so easy. He was so bigger. He looked bigger than everybody. And I never saw him like really training hard, you know?
That's the thing about Paul. I trained in the gym with him many times. I've never, ever seen him lift heavy weights.
Yeah.
I mean, he'd do good form and everything like that, but it was, I mean, the weights he was using, John, did not match his muscle size.
No, not at all. I mean, used to seeing someone like Tom Platz or Arnold or Yates. I mean, these guys trained so hard till their eyeballs were popping out of the sock.
He never trained. He hardly broke a sweat. But, you know, he trained regularly. I mean, you know, but the thing is, he would do a set, and it was like his muscles would pump up extraordinarily big. I remember one time he did a pec deck exercise, one set, and his pecs looked like they were going to explode off his chest.
Unbelievable.
It's just I kind of think I wrote this in an article in my newsletter on my Applied Metabolics. I suggested that Paul could possibly have at least one gene missing for myostatin because he just responded too easy.
But he wasn't like that in the beginning, right? He was skinny.
No, he was skinny. But when these guys start to work out, they just blow right up, even without steroids.
Yeah.
If they take steroids, it triples the effect.
I wonder what he looked like before he took steroids.
Well, yeah, that's a good question. You mean after he trained for a while?
Yeah.
Actually, believe it or not, he got big very fast.
Okay.
Not as big as he got later on as a pro, don't get me wrong.
I was wondering if it was just, you know, there's certain guys, and I think Flex Wheeler is one of them, that when they take steroids, they just blow up. And I've seen this before in my experience in the gym. I've seen guys, you know, that got on a 3-month cycle and just they didn't even look like the same person.
Well, Flex Wheeler himself told me that he was tested and he does lack a gene for myostatin.
Oh, really?
Yes, he told me that himself. That would explain why he responds. Because like I say, lacking myostatin alone gives you the tendency to be more muscular, but it won't make you look like a professional bodybuilder. You'll look kind of like an athletic guy, but not like a super bodybuilder. However, if you train and you take steroids and you have, let's say, a missing gene for myostatin, you're going to get that Flex Wheeler, Paul DeLette freak look where the muscles get ridiculously big. You know what I mean? I'm pretty sure he was one of those guys.
Don't you think that's part of being a good pro bodybuilder, Jerry, is like how you respond to steroids? Because it seems like people respond to them differently.
Absolutely. Everybody does respond. I've seen guys over the years that, believe it or not, I've seen guys, especially Arnold.
Yes.
I saw maybe 12 different guys train with Arnold. Now, one thing about Arnold was he was generous when it came to telling others what he did. He wasn't one of the, well, I'm going to, you know, I'm not going to mention name. I'm going to keep it secret because I'm not going to let the other guys know. Arnold wasn't like that. He would let the guys, he would give them his whole steroid routine. And these guys took the same exact drug program. The same dosages, the same orals, the same injectables. Ask me if even one of them came close to looking like Arnold.
No.
The guy who came closest to being successful was Ed Corney, you know. But Ed Corney, of course, was a great bodybuilder, but he wasn't on Arnold's level.
No, no.
You know what I mean, so, in other words, it was. And of course, we've talked about Danny Padilla.
Yeah,
was another guy who responded just ridiculously well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He would blow up like a balloon.
I would say like Padilla, Arnold, Kevin Lavroni was like that.
Kevin Lavroni is like that too.
Lex Wheeler, Paul DeLette. Yeah. Those guys just blew up.
Yeah, I would say to answer your question, you know, the response to the anabolic drugs does make a big difference on how successful you will be, especially as a pro bodybuilder, as a pro body. If you don't respond to drugs properly, you're not going to make it. It's that simple. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not going to happen.
I won the Natural Universe that year in 92, and it was in Venice, California, and it was in December. And it was at Venice Beach High School. I think I mentioned this before. So it was on a Saturday. So on Sunday, I went into Gold's Gym, you know, just to walk in. And I think Paul DeLette there, and he was doing leg presses, and I think he might have had 4 plates on each side. It was nothing, you know. He wasn't squatting. Yeah. And he got up, and I just went up to him, and I go, wow, you're as big as you are in the magazine or something. So then we talked. We had a little small talk. Yeah. And I told him, he goes, you look like you competed. And I said, yeah, I competed last night. He goes, what show? And I said, the Natural Mr. Universe. He goes, really? They have Natural Mr. Universe? He just thought it was the most ridiculous concept to have a natural contest, you know?
I don't see why that's ridiculous. I don't, you know.
Because I think he thought bodybuilding means steroids.
Oh, drugs. Yeah, right.
Just the fact that there's a natural contest, he's like, what? It was like the weirdest thing, you know?
You know, that brings up an interesting topic. Here's a question for you, John. Did you ever stop and think what you would have looked like if you had taken the drug programs these guys use? I mean, because you had a lot of great genetics yourself.
Yeah.
You had the great shape and the good structure. Did you ever stop and think, what do you think it would have done for you?
Well, that's why I was asking about the drug response, because I don't know if I think I told you this before. I did take steroids for a small period of time. After I turned 21, I was 230 natural. And then I was going to compete in the NPC because there was no natural shows around, really. So I thought, you know, if you want to make it in bodybuilding. So I knew I was going to have to take something. So I took real small dosages, and I would take them 12 weeks before the show. But I was like, when I started, I was 230 in the off season natural. And for a show, I was 205.
Oh.
While on the drugs, I would lose 25 to 30 pounds. I didn't get bigger. I think they helped me recuperate and I kept my strength up.
Yeah.
But I never seemed to get a good response from. I remember I was always like really disappointed. I was like, wow, this is all they do, you know?
Yeah.
And then after like a few years of that, I never really went any. I won state and local shows, but I never went. Like, I went to the junior nationals. I took 10. I didn't even make top 10. I couldn't even make top 10. I was a 205, 5'8" heavyweight. Yeah. So then I just said, well, I'm quitting. I'm not going to compete anymore. Because they were saying, you know, if you want to play with these guys, you got to do more cycle. You got to do them in the off season. You got to cycle. Like, you got to do bigger dosages than what you're doing. Because I was using really small dosages.
Right.
But I was like, I don't know. Somewhere in the back of my mind, I was like, I don't think it's going to make a difference. I don't know. I just don't seem to respond to them, you know, because I would see guys in the gym that would blow up on them, and I never blew up on them. So I don't know.
Maybe if you had taken them, remember, you were taking them when you were in a kind of
dieting, cycle. Yeah.
Dieting, you were training very hard.
Yeah.
And going by what you're talking about, the dosages, I believe they did exactly what you just said. They helped you retain muscle and strength. That's what they did, but they didn't put a lot of size on you.
Just
remember, when you're in a caloric deficit and you're not eating as much, it's even with the steroids, they've shown this in studies, you can't put on a lot of size. You have to be eating a lot more. That's why they talk about the pros today eating so much, and they got the belly load up. That's part of that works with the steroids to give them that size. But I would suggest that if you had taken greater dosages of the steroids
in the off season.
Yeah, in the off season, you probably would have noticed a different result.
Yeah.
If you say that you were 230, was that off season? 230 was off season, right?
230 bulked up, yeah. Sometimes even 240, and that was all natural. That was no drugs.
I wouldn't be surprised if you had taken the drugs, you probably could have gotten to do 250 and still look muscular. And I'm not talking no fat, I'm talking maybe a little bit smooth. But you would have been muscular. That's what I think would happen. You know, but you're right though. There's different responses to the steroid. We know this. Some guys just, you know, don't.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I saw an interview with Dorian Yates, and he said he actually took more steroids in the off season to get bigger. Yeah, like he was taking more growth hormone and more steroids when he was in the off season. He was eating a lot.
Right.
That's when he focused on taking more stuff, you know, to get really bigger.
Well, that makes sense, because in the off season, you know, it's like the old system we used years ago. Remember the bulking up?
Yeah.
You bulk up in the off season when you weren't preparing, you'd eat more food and this and that.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense that he would use more drugs in the off season when he was trying to get bigger and stronger.
Yeah.
Whereas when the contest came around, the focus was on getting as hard and ripped as possible while maintaining as much muscle. So he would go on lower dosages, just like you used it for, to maintain the muscle, but without worrying about excess water retention and this and that. So what he did actually makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, that makes it more sense. I mean, to take a ton of drugs right before the contest, like a lot of guys don't know this. For example, they think growth hormone is a cutting drug because they heard it burns fat. What they don't know is that growth hormone is an extreme water retaining drug because it stimulates a hormone from the adrenal glands called aldosterone, which retains sodium and water in the body. It functions to maintain the blood volume, but if you take large amounts of growth hormone, you're going to get this huge water retention effect. So if you take growth hormone up to a contest, you're going to be scratching your head. Wait, I'm doing everything right. I'm dieting. I'm doing this. Why am I still smooth? Why am I holding all this water?
So they don't take the growth hormone when they're getting ready for shows?
Uh-huh.
They don't take the growth when they're getting ready for shows?
Oh, no, they do. A lot of guys do, you know. I mean, and at the 90 Olympia, a couple of the guys told me they were on only growth hormone because that was, remember, that was the, that was the only, but you see, the deal there is the you're probably saying, well, how come they still look pretty cut? The reason was they were also taking a lot of diuretics.
Mm.
See, if you take the diuretics, it offsets the water retention.
Oh, okay, okay.
That's the trick. That's the trick,
Yeah, because I've seen guys in the, like I said, I remember there was a guy named Jerry, actually. He was the owner of my gym, and he just casually worked out. He wasn't that serious about it. He was a tall guy. He was about 6'2". Right. He had an okay build. And I remember one time I came into the gym in the summer, and he was huge. I mean, he looked like Arnold. He was wearing a tank top. His chest was out to here. His arms. I couldn't believe it was the same guy. I was like, Jerry?
Yeah.
And he went on a 3-month cycle because he was getting married. And he just blew up. I couldn't believe the size he had. And then as soon as he got married, he got off the cycle, went back to his normal way of living, and he shrunk right back down to what he used to be.
Let me understand you here. Are you saying, this is something new. I've never heard this one. Are you saying this guy took steroids to get bigger for his marriage?
For his wedding, yeah. I guess he wanted to look good in the wedding pictures.
That's something I've never heard before. That's a first. I've heard steroids used for different purposes, but never to get married.
Yeah.
That's news to me.
But like that, the DeMello guy that we were talking about.
Yeah.
I remember when I competed with him at the junior nationals, I think I weighed 200 pounds in that contest. And that was when I was using drugs. He was 215. So then 6 years later in 1992, that was when I saw that picture of him, and he was natural and he was 185. So that's 30 pounds difference. When I won the natural universe, I was 198. Hmm. 2 pound difference. It was like no difference really, you know?
Yeah.
I remember the first time I used them, I was, we had a big mirror in the gym, and when everybody was getting ready for a contest, like a week or two out from the show, they'd go over on the weekend and they'd take their shirt off and they'd pose in front of this mirror, and the whole gym would come over and watch to see what you look like, you know? So, the owner of the gym and, this other guy who was probably like the best bodybuilder in our gym, they were watching me pose. And so then after I got done, I put my shirt on, everybody left. So they called me over and they go, what are you doing? I go, what do you mean? They go, what steroids are you doing? And I said, well, I'm doing 4 Anavar. They go, what? 4 Anavar? He goes, you pissed that out before you even got here. He goes, everybody's taking 20. He goes, go home and take 16 more.
Right. Yeah. I know that's it. Yeah. Yeah.
Those are the little 2.5 milligram ones. You know?
Right. Yeah, that would be enough to, again, help you retain some muscle.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe some strength, but it's not going to make you big.
No,
you
know? No.
Yeah,
I remember I was always, every time I took them, I was kind of disappointed.
Yeah. I mean, Anavar is the drug that's one of the drugs favored by women.
Yeah.
It's more anabolic than androgenic, so there's less chance of,
That's what I was taking. I was taking high anabolic, low androgenic. Yeah.
You know, with the androgenic, supposedly that's what causes the water retention, blah, blah, a lot of the side effects. But, women make that mistake. I've had women, well, not to me, but I've heard women think that they could stand something like Anavar year round and, you know, they can get away with it. But they don't understand that even one Anavar tablet, one, is more testosterone than they ever make in their bodies.
Yeah.
So you take it year round and you are going to get it's inevitable.
Yeah.
They get, and the androgenic side effects that women get, like the deeper voice and stuff, that's permanent.
Yeah.
Guys get side effects from steroids. Most of the time, the side effects recede when they get off the drug.
Yeah.
But women, and the side effects stay, especially structural. Changes in the sex organs, the voice, hair loss, that's permanent.
Yeah.
So any woman should really think twice before she starts talking about taking steroids year round. She's going to change herself.
Plus, I think now they think they're taking Anavar and they're not. They're taking something else because there's so much phony stuff around, you know?
Yeah, who knows what they're taking. If they're getting it from these underground, internet sites, you don't know what you're getting. I mean, I was tempted, to be honest with you, just last week, I was tempted to send away for some peptides, not steroids.
Yeah.
There's one called BPC 157.
I heard of that, yeah.
Yeah, which I've written, I've actually written about and did a video on. It's supposedly very good for healing. I wanted to see, my shoulders are perpetually sore. You know, it really hurts my work. It's arthritis. But I wanted to see if I take the BPC 157, it seemed to have a good safety record. You know, maybe it'll help me reduce some inflammation and train harder or whatever.
Yeah.
And I was just about ready to do it. And I realized, I said, wait a minute, these are not legitimate drug companies, these so-called peptide sites. I said, I don't know if I'm getting real BPC 157.
Yeah.
I canned it. Even though I really wanted to try it, I just didn't. I said, I can't trust these. I don't know who these people are.
Yeah.
I don't know the quality control. I canned the idea. I never wound up sending for it.
Yeah.
I just don't trust the underground drug
stuff. I heard a lot of people are taking that stuff.
Oh, yeah, a lot of them are, you know. And I'm not saying all of it's fake.
Yeah.
Some of them, a lot of it is probably real. Don't get me wrong. But the trouble is, you don't know.
Yeah.
And remember, there's always the placebo effect. Do you believe something is going to work?
Yeah.
It could be just salt water.
Yeah. You
know, these guys, for all I know, are buying BPC 157. And it's a saline injecting salt water. And you see me, hey, how do you feel? Oh, my shoulders are so I can't believe how well this works. It's the placebo effect. But you know what the funny thing is? There's a real effect involved. Because even though the drug itself is not doing anything, their belief in that it's doing something is stimulating certain chemicals in the body called endorphins, which are natural painkillers. And if they believe in it enough, they might get enough endorphin release to actually kill the pain, making them believe that the drug actually helped. And this goes true. This is true for a lot of supplements.
Yeah.
A lot of guys believe in certain supplements that are not doing shit for them, but because they totally believe in them, they will get actual results, but it's the placebo effect, not the supplement. But as I always say, the way I look at it is this. If you're taking a supplement, let's say, and it's a placebo, but your arms are growing, you're getting stronger, who gives a shit?
Right. It's working.
I mean, you know what I mean? I mean, you know, if you're actually getting results, who cares if it's a placebo?
Right.
That's the way I look at it, you know?
Right, exactly. All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks again to Jerry Branham for joining us on the show again. I also should mention that I just put up, if you're on a YouTube, I just put up our interview with Jerry from 1971, where we focused on the year 1971. And we talked about the 1971 AAU Mr. America. And also the 1971 IFBB Mr. USA and Mr. World and the IFBB Mr. America, which was won by Ken Waller. So that is now up on YouTube. I know I'm way behind on some of these shows, but it took me a long time. It took me about 4 days this week to work on that because I added a lot of pictures. I went back into all my old Iron Man and Muscular Development magazines, and I found all these old pictures of that 1971 AAU Mr. America. So if you guys are looking for an entertaining show to watch, go to my YouTube channel under my name, John Hansen, and check that out. It's one of the latest episodes up on my YouTube channel. All right. And I did want to talk a little bit about the 1992 NPC Nationals, which Jerry and I forgot to mention. I apologize for that. I don't know how we forgot that, but as I was listening to it after we recorded it, I'm like, oh, man, we totally forgot the 1992 NPC Nationals. There's an article here from John Little that was in Flex magazine. So I'll just go over the winners. So the winner of the contest was John Tank Sherman. And John won his class at the MPC USA that year in 1992 that we just talked about with Flex Wheeler winning the overall. And John won first place and overall at the MPC Nationals that year in 1992. And just for some record, go over the winners up until that time. So, of course, Lee Haney was the winner in 1982, 10 years before. Bob Paris won in 83. Mike Christian won in 84. Phil Williams won in 85. Gary Strydom won in 86. Sean Ray won in 87. Vince Taylor won in 88. Troy Zuccolato won in 89. Al Q Gurley won in 1990. And Kevin Lebroni won in 91. So John Sherman has taken up the reins, and he was the 11th winner of the MPC Nationals. So it was still pretty much in its infancy. And I guess he gave a Lifetime Achievement Award to Lee Haney at this contest. And the contest was held in Orlando, Florida. The heavyweight winner was Chris Duffy. And Chris took second place to Flex at the MPC USA in July. So he came back and he won. And he beat out Bo Matlock in the heavyweights. Bo Matlock, I remember he had a really good physique. Never turned pro, but really made an impact on some of the shows back then in the 90s and the 80s. And Edgar Fletcher, another great bodybuilder who never turned pro, he was in third place. They said he just wasn't cut enough, but he definitely had everything he needed to turn professional. Daryl Stafford was second to John Sherman in the light heavyweights, and James Harrison was third. And then the winner of the middleweights was Tom Varga. He had a good physique, but he never really did anything. He had some good thighs. I remember that. Jose Figueroa was second, and Joseph Hubbard was third. And then the lightweight class went to Mike Winters. I think Mike was from Indiana because I remember him competing when I was in Chicago. And Billy Saffold was in second place, and Ed Panchu was third. And then Kelly Pettiford, I remember him. He won the bantamweight class. So that was the MPC Nationals. All right, so let me get to this article that was written by Rick Wayne, and this comes from the May 1983 issue of Muscle and Fitness. I was kind of surprised that they had the Mr. Olympia report all the way in May when the contest was probably held in October. So that was a long wait, but that's how it was back then. You had to wait a long time, like 6 months or so, to get the report of the contest, not like today where you get it immediately. You can watch it live and everybody's talking about it like 1 minute after the show's over. But anyways, this was a great article by Rick Wayne. It's called Beef, 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 the Showdown of the Year, when bodybuilding was touted as the sport of the 80s. And this is the 1982 Olympia conclusion. It says, at the Nag's Head pub in London, on a good Saturday night, only a spill or two away from cosmopolitan Leicester Square, where Grace Jones' haircuts are unisex and de rigueur, and every other face wears an adamant mask, and tourists zealously cheer daredevil parakeets on careening toy tandems, and sanctimonious Jesus freaks flaunt their gloomy placards and their arrogance, my Irish friend assured me that many years ago the cold country took a woozy look at New York, Detroit, and Chicago. The way to San Jose was closed for the day. Pronounced the American lifestyle a rat race to be avoided, like the pox yet, buried its narcoleptic head in a slough of despond called British tradition, and promptly dropped out. Look around you, lad, Paddy gurgled under a Niagara of gargle. You're in a land of bleeding Van Winkles, me boy. Merry England's been asleep for 100 years. Not by the evidence, Paddy baby. The morning we arrived in London, even the sun was taking a shine to Maggie Thatcher, who by all accounts was finally winning a round in the universal war against inflation. The price of filet made dinner for two, un filet à deux, but never mind. The long-range Downing Street forecast promised a Merry Christmas. And if that wasn't enough to keep the cheery juices bubbling, well, old chap, there was always next day's Olympia. Britain never had it so good. 9 months earlier, almost as soon as tickets to the renowned IFBB event became available, local punk rockers, tattooed skinheads, and born-again mods, yes, the straight and the fruit-flavored too, had made a beeline for the box office and grabbed up every seat in the Wembley Conference Center by underground, only a 30-minute ride from Piccadilly, which must have warmed up Oscar State, not to mention his partners in hock, Michael Stern and David Riley. By Ben Weider's account, the adventuresome threesome had forked out in excess of $200,000 for the privilege of staging for the first time in England the event that universally had been justly acclaimed the Super Bowl of bodybuilding. The American contingent was welcomed at Heathrow by representatives of their airline and taken to a VIP lounge to await special transportation to the Crest Hotel, where Oscar sat in state just a few yards from the Wembley Conference Center. In July, each contender had received from the organizers of the 82 Olympia written information concerning airline tickets for personal use and for wives, girl, and other friends, hotel accommodations, and meals. Consequently, registration at the Crest flowed like a well-oiled concerto. As promised, each man received from Oscar the cost of his room plus $35
for meals and incidental expenses. The contestants would assume individual responsibility for settling their hotel accounts after the Olympia. Contenders had been forewarned to have on hand and ready for delivery to Oscar upon arrival at the Crest such cannerous recordings as were intended for use during the contest. Enlightened by bitter experience, the organizers had cautiously proffered recording advice to the contenders. Your music must be on a tape cassette, and it must start at the beginning of the cassette. We will not accept a cassette on which your music starts somewhere near the middle. Oscar, where were you on the night of the American Championships when Wayne D'Amelio so desperately needed you? All contenders have been given advance notice not to take with them any unannounced managers, coaches, friends, and other supporters. No one would be allowed to accompany the contestants backstage. With a total of 23 competitors and officials attending, noted the organizers, there'll be no room for extra bodies. Dead right. There was more reason to mourn. We regret to inform you that sales of any kind in the lobby of the Wembley Conference Center are under the control of the management, who require a fee of £50 for a table from which to sell your merchandise. But there were compensations. Each of the 16 registered Olympia contenders would have equal opportunity to take home the coveted Wieder Trophy and $25,000 besides. There would be 6 gold-plated awards for the first half dozen finalists, not to mention still another $25,000 to be shared among the first runner-up and 8 other lucky participants. Moreover, 2 Grand Prix events in Sweden and Belgium, scheduled for the week following the Olympia, promised another $30,000. Determined this year to avoid tears and begrudging eyes, the organizers furnished the competing musclemen with a list of nominated judges so that they might take the opportunity before the event to express agreement or dissatisfaction with the chosen panel. If you object to any of them, an IFBB memo cautioned, you must place an X beside his name. Naturally, objectors were required to state in writing reasons for their objections, but that did not guarantee expulsion of those judges. By current rules of the game, it would take, quote, a substantial number of competitors to object to a judge before we can agree to remove him. We cannot extend to any competitor the right of veto of a judge on his opinion alone, unquote. Herewith, the list of judges: Jacques Blumhardt, chief judge from Belgium, Roger Schwab from the USA, Franco Fossi from Italy, Walter van de Breden from Holland, Doug Evans from Wales, Ludwig Nosek from Czechoslovakia, Winston Roberts from Canada, and Julian Blumhardt from Belgium. John Martin and Mike Down, both of England, were listed as alternate judges. On the evening of the day before the Olympia, November 12th, the following professional bodybuilders met under the chairmanship of IFBB President Ben Wieder: Samir Banut, Albert Beckles, Boyer Coe, Chris Dickerson, Lance Dreher, Bertel Fox, Johnny Fuller, Mohamed Makawe, Jacques Nouville, Danny Padilla, Tom Platz, Dennis Tinerino, Casey Viator, Roger Walker, Josip Wilkosz, and Frank Zane. Also in attendance were Wayne D'Amelio, who recently replaced me as the umbilical cord between the IFBB and the pros, and has my thanks and my sympathies, Bill Pearl, and an assortment of managers and judges. Ron Davies, chairman of the English Federation of Bodybuilders, EFBB, opened the meeting, welcomed the visitors, and introduced Ben Wieder, who went on to inform the Olympia veterans before him that contests conducted under IFBB rules cannot be fixed. He said contenders would have another opportunity before the meeting ended to comment on the panel that the IFBB judges committee had selected for the 82 Olympia. Oscar State volunteered an on-the-spot clarification of the rules governing IFBB competition. When he solicited ideas for the smooth announcement of the Olympia finalists, Boyer Coe suggested all contenders should return to the stage at the end of the free posing round for the delectation of the audience and then retire to the wings to await the MC's announcements. As each name was called, the Magnificent Six would take turns on the posing rostrum. That suggestion received unanimous support. Another by Coe hit the dust. Boyer had proposed that professional bodybuilders be required to meet their own travel and hotel expenses. Freed from such financial burden, Coe reasoned, show promoters could offer larger purses than were currently paid. This suggestion was never put to the vote for the simple reason that while it was being made, the voting majority had vacated the room. Presumably, Cole will revive the matter at the next appropriate opportunity. The nominees were ordered out before the attendant Olympia contenders were invited to comment on the next day's adjudicating panel. As had been the case in 1980 and 81, there were no complaints. Presumably, Olympia contenders sleep late, or maybe they breakfast privately. No one was to be seen at the hotel restaurant when I went there shortly after 8 o'clock on the morning of the big event. In the elevator on my way back to my quarters, I bumped into Frank Zane gingerly holding a small plastic tray upon which sat two indiscernible objects wrapped in aluminum foil. Noting my mystification, he said, or I thought he said, baked hams. He quickly set the record straight. After all, no other bodyman had been more often misquoted. Yams, said the former school teacher. Got them from a guy who used to be my manager. One of the hotel cooks prepared them for me. Throughout the last 2 months of his preparations, Frank had issued carbohydrates, his way of shredding disfiguring fat and sharpening the cuts and striations that for 7 years had made him a legend. On the day of the contest, when other less discriminating contenders would be taking sustenance from chocolate bars, bananas, and suspicious bottles, Frank would eat his specially prepared yams. He knew nothing better for keeping him high. The day before our encounter in the hotel elevator, he'd made a shocking discovery. The yams he brought all the way from Palm Springs, California, which the dutiful Christine had with her own hands lovingly baked, were rotten to the core. Yet Frank hadn't read into that any sign of calamity. He shook his head when an evil person suggested he psych out Bertle Fox post-haste, noting that Bertle already had his fair share of trouble. Carious tubers notwithstanding, Frank fully expected to be Mr. Olympia for a fourth year. Otherwise, what would have been the point in his and Christine's leaving Zane Haven? Samir Benoot might have hazarded a guess. Shortly after arriving at the crest, the two champions had stripped for the NBC cameras, and Samir had come away convinced that after three odiose safaris, it was finally his turn to bag the Olympia. The other contenders didn't matter. Everyone said Zane was the man to beat. Well, later for him. Samir had his number. Just in case the reporter harbored doubts as to the quality of the forecast, Samir exposed some of his best parts right there on the corridor of the top floor of the crest. After that, the reporter had to admit that he'd never seen Samir better prepared for a hunt. I don't want to read in your report one word about water, roared the Lion of Lebanon. He crossed his arms vigorously so that his mountainous pecs leaped for his Adam's apple. Whoa, just look at those veins. Even Rick Wayne at his best never had better. Now he grabbed his head with both hands, gyrated his hips like an exotic dancer, whistled the air out of his body. Come on, he said. Feel my abs. Nothing but skin. Ah, and muscle, right? Right. One did not expect to encounter Bertle Fox in the vicinity of the crest, where the hounds lived. He had opted to bivouac with his mama, where he'd be safe. The unconfirmed word was that he'd gone off his diet 2 weeks earlier, that he wouldn't show up for the contest, that he secretly planned to stay on in London, his American dream having commiced into a curdy nightmare. One knew otherwise. Whatever wicked dreams had abused his curtain sleep, Bertle planned to be hot and smoking at Olympia time. That much he guaranteed the hand that feeds him. One of the hazards of journalism is that it can leave you straddling the business edge of a straight razor if you insist on writing as if truth and objectivity were necessarily synonymous. Not long ago, when I offered what I considered my inoffensive impressions of the ambiance at a particular West Coast gym, one of the proprietors promised to do to my body such things as wouldn't be allowed on a movie screen without an certificate. It's hardly surprising that so many show reviews have left a taste of pablum in the reader's mouth. When a reporter says everyone in a contest was equally great, you know he must be lying through his teeth. Yet it's the way some writers stay alive, albeit with two vital components of their masculinity missing, a condition that scares me even more than the demented muscle man on the warpath. So, ever mindful of the fact that rubbish, like beauty, resides in the eye of the beholder, I shall call the shots exactly as I witnessed them in London. Predictability was never the mother of excitement. While the European mixed pairs event, which preceded the Olympia, offered a glimpse of one young man destined for high places in bodybuilding, it lacked that ineffable thrill that always accompanies real contests. From the moment the Europeans appeared on stage at the Wembley Conference Center, it was obvious who would be the lucky pair. Seven couples participated. Marlene Fuhrer and Harry Durglin from Switzerland, Amanda Balderson and Bill Tierney from England, Hildegard Schaefer and Gabriel Wild from West Germany, Mayo Saline and Keo Ryman from Finland, Carolyn Cheshire and Andrew Searle from England, Tone Oppheim and Harold Skojolt from Norway, Eric Ames and Barry DeMay from Holland. Let us now invent some much-needed suspense and say that Miss Cheshire, a pussycat who is to British television audiences what Rachel McLish is to women watchers in America, had polished her physique since her appearance at the Miss Olympia a month or so earlier. At Wembley, she was lithe, sensuous, sported a fashionably curly, diply-do hairdo, and a young man whose posing was remarkable. Let us say Bill Tierney was wide and densely muscled. And let's suggest Keo Ryman carried enough to give a charging rhino pause. No matter, one couple dominated the affair, as we shall see. Nevertheless, the judging dragged on from 10 a.m. to midday when Oscar State mercifully announced that the Olympia would commence exactly at 1 p.m. Among the first contenders to enter the backstage warm-up area was the Egyptian Mohamed Makaway, eyes sharp as drills, face lean as a hibernating gopher's, hair cropped almost to his scalp. For the last 2 years or so, he made his home in Toronto, where he managed a gym for Ken Wheeler's Canadian company, Super Fitness. Life was good for McAway, even though American promoters displayed no great eagerness to engage him for seminars and exhibitions. He was happy. At least one dream had come true since his move to Canada. Wheeler had arranged a meeting with Vince Gironda, whom the Egyptian had long admired from afar. At Wheeler's expense, McAway had spent 3 weeks in Los Angeles training according to the gospel of Gironda. McAway had found the old iron guru a personality most refreshing, completely unpredictable. At times, Vince was disturbingly unsophisticated. But then the proof of his coaching had surprised the hell out of those who butted against McAway at the 82 Night of the Champions. The title went to Britain's Albert Beckles, but long after the curtain came down, the best words were from McAway. Everyone agreed he was bigger than ever, yet his definition took your breath away. His symmetry was beyond reproof. Indeed, in my review of the contest, I'd written in effect that the Egyptian offered his audience a vivid picture of what Chris Dickerson's stage routine might be like with muscles. I'd thrown caution to the winds, blown whatever cover I might have had by baldly stating that for my money, McAway had been the best man in New York. Afterwards, McAway continued to take his medicine by phone. At least once a week, he communed with Gironda, who seemed to know each of the more than one ways to skin a cat. McAway was one of the casualties of the Las Vegas event that failed to eventuate. He trained like the clappers for that contest and was dashed when it fell through. After a short recuperative break, however, during which he indulged every Epicurean excess imaginable, he had bounced right back. In early September, he turned his attention to the Olympia. First, he dieted. Yes, even before embarking on his special weight training program. If that sounds like cart before the mule to conventional Olympic contenders, let it be. It has been McAway's way since embracing Gironda. By the time the Egyptian was into his 6th week of Olympia preparations, there were a few observers who didn't think he'd already surpassed the form he displayed in New York. No wonder McAway was cocky in London. Danny Padilla followed McAway into the warm-up enclosure, sweat-suited, flat, not at all his usual bubbly self. He proffered a sneak preview of his thighs and calves, which were impressive in the absence of other prize exhibits, announced that since the Olympia appearance the previous year, he'd gained 6 pounds of muscle, but at great cost. While working out with over 1,000 pounds on the calf machine, Danny had injured an Achilles tendon, necessitating emergency surgery. Later, rescuing a dizzy gym damsel in distress, Danny had severely damaged his deltoids. Despite the advertised canals in his thighs, his Olympia preparations had gone down the toilet. You knew Danny was bound for still more disaster. Before long, the backstage activity was steaming as one by one the trunks-clad gladiators surfaced from their subterranean dressing rooms. Casey Viator wore black, while nearby McAway stretched and twisted about like a calculating jungle cat, Casey attacked the weights. Packing more gunpowder than old Guy Fawkes himself, Casey huffed and puffed until he seemed capable of succeeding where the other guy had failed and blowing both houses of parliament away. Believe it, this Casey meant business. Australia's Roger Walker was almost as pale as the white sweatsuit that enveloped him. Wordlessly, he betook himself to a quiet corner where he performed effortless ballet splits and posed in slow motion. Boyer Code's most conspicuous recent acquisition was a black beard trimmed a la Reeves of Hercules. He said friends had assured him it made him appear young. Friends? Frank Zane wore a blue velour gym outfit and toted a canvas tote bag, presumably with his baked yams snuggled up inside. Albert Beckles pumped up his shoulders and arms in a Stay Hard t-shirt. Chris Dickerson was aglow in honest sweat and Johnson's baby oil when he surfaced from his secret hideout, also carrying a handbag. Bertle Fox trotted in with less than 10 minutes to spare. Half an hour earlier, we'd talked in his dressing room. He assured me then that despite his countenance, he was in high spirits. He was anointing himself when a gopher came by to say that it was nearly time to begin round one. In the shadow of the Black Widow, Bertle muttered something unprintable. McCauley led the 16-man lineup, Fox trapped between him and Frank Zane. We can only speculate on what Penzi's metaphysiques jutterbugged in Bertle's beleaguered brain when he discovered the position he had received during the dip for numbers. Indeed, rumor was that he hadn't picked the number two spot he now occupied, but that in his absence, Julian Blumhardt had done the honors. The lineup had barely settled down. Oscar State was still doing his cool utmost to police the elbowing that has recently become de rigueur at Beef Meats, when Bertle unleashed a series of most muscular shots clearly meant to rattle the bones of the smaller men flanking him. McCauley just gave a sphinx-like smile. If Zane noticed, nothing in his stage manner betrayed concern. He maintained his pose. Heels together, thighs, abs, pecs, lats, triceps, arms rigid, head held high, a true professional at home with the rules. Disdain was the word that best described Zane's demeanor in the face of the irregularities that flared up and down the line. Where the audience was concerned, however, Bertle's muscle shots had hit the bullseye. Immediately following every Fox strut, the crowd exploded in a noise much like heavy booing that later turned out to be the quaint British way of acknowledging the presence of unbelievable muscle mass, something that Fox carried in large supply. Beef went the 2,000-gun salute. Beef! Danny Padilla stepped forward and pointed to his tense thighs, but the audience had eyes only for the heavyweight version, as featured by Platts. Tommy, they hollered, not at all in the manner of, say, Sir John Gielgud. Tommy, Tommy. Benute offered a lat spread fit for wide-angle lenses only and was rewarded with the sound of booing that was cheering. Viator whipped up a pair of awesome biceps with similar sound effects, and Dickerson, maintaining his usual composure, his near-shaven head knowing and aloof, through it all, a monolithic Dennis Tenorino benignly smiled and smiled and smiled like Big Brother under the newly acquired Bill Pearl mustache. A reluctant Walker reminded of a giant studio reflector. Turn to the rear. Like beads on a rosary, the practice contenders reacted synergically to State's command. Benute, Dreyer, Beckles, Tenorino stood out. Zane's upper work spoke of torturous peak contraction workouts and meticulous dieting. But like foothills before the mountains, there were ominous little folds around his lower back. Now Oscar orders the lineup off stage. They will be recalled, first one by one, then in groups, for further scrutiny by the judges who are seated in the front row of the packed auditorium. As the parade files for the wings and more inflation in the pump-up area, Viator grabs one more opportunity to blow kisses to the cheering crowd. Fox adds to the pandemonium by serving the beef viewers' second helpings. Halfway through the first round, the consensus was that Chris Dickerson would be the hard man to beat. Back in California, the persistent word was that he bulked up and suffered the loss of his characteristic clear-cut definition. The rumor had received additional thrust from the hard fact of Dickerson's disappearance from the usual Santa Monica body shops months before the Big O. Little did the rumor mongers know that the object of their demotion had simply hied himself off to friendlier climes, to Bill Pearl's, in effect, where the old master had set about restoring the winning Dickerson physique. He was so out of shape when he came to me, Pearl would later reveal, that I wouldn't let him practice his routine in posing trunks when other people were present. The two longtime friends had for nearly 3 months turned up at Pearl's gym every day at 3 a.m. for gruesome workouts that did not end until close to 7 a.m. And clearly their regimen had paid off. Chris was bigger than he'd been for the three previous Olympias, yet he retained the fine lines and separation for which he was particularly famous. 1 week earlier, the photographer Artie Zeller and I had been assured by a former mentor of Samir's that he'd taken a close look at the Banute physique and found it wanting for definition. Well, not by the evidence displayed at Wembley. After the 81 Olympia, Samir had sworn to be in winning form for his next appearance, and he had kept his promise. Indeed, there was hardly a time when he wasn't being compared on stage with the likes of Zane, Beckles, Dickerson, Casey, and McCauley, the obvious leaders in the field. Johnny Fuller was also expected to be near the gold at the end of the day. He packed on more muscle, and if he wasn't the most handsome face on the show, well, in every department save looks, Fuller seemed a sure winner. Boyer Coe obviously disappointed many who came expecting great things of him. He seemed underweight. If he was ripped all over, that was hardly surprising when you considered his size. His back seemed flat. The light had gone out in his usually flaring lats. But Boyer was a fighter, plain and simple. He betrayed not a sign that he considered himself below his usual standard. No one of much account seemed to be paying any attention to Bertle Fox. He was compared most often with Fuller and Beckles, both hungry predators and on the scent of fresh meat, Bertles. Meanwhile, their quarry offered lopsided bicep shots, flaccid pecs, spasmodic thighs. Josip Lukasz packed his usual heavy artillery, but Herculean mass alone was hardly enough to see him through this particular labor. Dennis Tinerino, at some 235 pounds, the biggest man in the contest, complained of being overlooked by the judges. "They keep only comparing the little guys," Dennis decried. "How can they decide McCauley or Padilla is better than me if they don't put us up against each other?" A despondent Lance Dreher concurred. Not so Boyer Coe. He said the judges were doing their best and that was good enough for him, unquote. Samir Banute complained that his music was turned too low during the free posing presentation. "I couldn't hear a blinking thing," he said. "You suppose somebody's trying to sabotage me?" The resourceful Zane had left nothing to chance. He had given special instructions to the day's DJs and Oscar State. "Be sure to ask the audience to hold their applause until I'm through posing," he warned the MC. The announcement was not without surprising impact, but the fans were cooperative. They restrained themselves until the music stopped. How were they to know it would quickly start all over again, albeit at a different tempo? They caught on fast, however, and Zane ended his presentation to a rousing ovation. Poor Danny Padilla. He lost his briefs and was forced to appear in what looked like longs. Nay, the tale grows grimmer. The erstwhile giant killer had gone and picked for himself number 13. After that, it had to be downhill all the way. The judging ended shortly after 6 p.m. Naturally, everyone had their own winning order. The name you heard most often in first place at this point was Casey Viator. But Banute, Dickerson, and McCauley had their share of supporters. Surprisingly, Platts turned out not to be as much of a dead cert as he'd been in 81 when he lost out to both Franco Colombo and Chris Dickerson. Ah, but the day was yet young. At 7:30, the evening audience had filled the hall. Ron Davies came to the mic to thank one and all for their support, promising a truly wonderful show, and introduced the ISPB's European Vice President, Julian Blumhardt. He said that it was an historic day for European bodybuilding and that it was the first European mixed pairs championship would soon be concluded. The day was also noteworthy, added Blumhardt, for marking the second coming of the Olympia to Europe. Germany had hosted the event in 1972. "I promise you a super time," said Blumhardt, "but first let me introduce our president, your president." Loud voices acknowledged Ben Weider, whose duty it was to officially welcome the packed house to the most important event on the IFBB calendar. "My only regret," he said, "is that thousands, I mean literally thousands of people could not purchase tickets to this evening's competition because this massive center is too small." He thanked Oscar State for his loyalty and devotion. It was largely in deference to Oscar that the IFBB had agreed to stage its most important event in London. When Oscar State returned as an MC, he called upon the audience to rise for the national anthem. Then it was back to business. The IFBB and the English Federation of Bodybuilders maintain that bodybuilding is a family sport, said Oscar. You are probably expected to see displays by adults only, but we have a surprise. Enter Tracy Allen and Michael Sutherland, ages 12 and 14, who offered a primer version of what the European mixed pairs would do in turn. The kids put on a fine display of adagio movements and muscle flexing and were roundly applauded. Then the grown-ups took the stage to continue what had been done for almost 2 hours that morning. Carolyn Cheshire and Andrew Seal were as impressive as they'd been earlier. Bill Tierney handed Amanda Boulderson as if she were a toy. Mario Celine and Kijo Ryman had been rehearsing their moves for 2 weeks only. Before that, Mario and her husband had been preoccupied with her Miss Olympia preparations at their present home in Washington, D.C. Mario had gone to her native Finland after the contest to prepare with Ryman for the European Championship. She expected victory because she felt she and her partner were equally equipped with muscle, unlike some of the other couples. Look around, Mario said in flawless English. Either the girl alone is good or the man alone is good. But I'm good and Kijo is good. We are a fine couple. Ryman wasn't quite so sanguine. He said that he was in better form some weeks earlier at the World Championships in Bruges when he placed second in his weight class. He definitely was much sharper then. Barry DeMay and Erica Mess had been prepping for the European Mixed Pairs contest for 5 months. They worked out at the same gym in Holland, but not as partners. The Wembley event was their first as a duo in May. DeMay had won the 82 European Championships in Zurich, and now he expected to win again with his feline partner. But he was not underestimating Ryman. You couldn't help thinking when DeMay was posing that he'd have given the Olympia contenders a run for their money. It came as no surprise when he and Mess were announced as the best of the European couples. Ryman and Celine were second. The question mark of the event hovered over Carolyn Cheshire, who was the pearl in the aluminum ring called Cyril, and Gabriel Wild, who did his best to support Miss Schaefer. When the dust settled, it was the last-named couple who got the nod. Miss Cheshire and her partner had to settle for fourth place, Stay Laguerre. As the intermission followed, whether the audience wanted it or not, time to talk again with the stars of the evening. Tenorino still had a few remarks about foul play. Fox was incommunicado, and Platts was joking that his blue eyes and blonde hair were responsible for his universal popularity. You couldn't help recalling that in Columbus the year before, Tom seemed to be taking matters much more seriously. Manute was having dire fat flashbacks, something to do with an altercation with a particular judge long ago, and was wondering if this might be Judgment Day. At one point, a message arrived from Bill Pearl to Chris Dickerson. Pearl wanted his man to pull out all the stops in the posing routine. Word had come down the grapevine that Zane, surprise, surprise, was baying at his heels. Meanwhile, Christine had had her quiet cry. Someone in the know had informed her that her husband would not realize this year's dream. Dickerson was ahead. Incredibly, Casey Viator was being pushed aside by rumor. Worse, the whispers suggested McCauley wasn't even in the running. Speculation upon speculations. Enough. You'd have thought, judging from the ovation according to the Olympia lineup, that the audience was seeing Dickerson, Zane, and the rest for the first time. Indeed, 99% of those present had witnessed the judging earlier. Mark you, there is no fan like a bodybuilding fan. Anywhere. Let's hear it for Bertel. If earlier he posed as if his heart were still at home with his mama, now he came out with blood in his eye. The castrating mandatory poses now out of the way, he yanked up one most muscular shot after another until you thought the audience would lose its collective mind. Yes, this Fox was a winner, if only with the partisan crowd. McCauley was, of course, flawless. His posing still reminded of the old Dickerson, but who cared? Honey was honey, regardless of the brand. The music you heard when McCauley was posing didn't come from the speakers. It came from the harmony of his parts. Casey bulldozed his way into the hearts of the British. He trained hard for this one and would be rewarded if fate held just one bone. Manute was superb, but he was dissatisfied at the end of his presentation with the way the operators had managed his tape. Coe posed to Eye of the Tiger and showed flashes of boxing talent, if nothing else. We've been here already. Once again, the audience was warned to sit on its hands during Zane's routine, but something went wrong at the gap. It left Zane hanging in midair. He waited and waited and waited, amidst an embarrassing silence for the coin to drop. When it did and the music continued, Zane carried on as if nothing had happened. to wild applause. Afterwards, he dashed backstage to rip out the lungs and liver of whoever was responsible for what Zayn felt for certain would cost him the Olympia. Friends held him back before blood flowed. Chris Dickerson left no doubt in anyone's mind when it comes to posing to music. He is egregio maestro. He and Pearl had chosen Trumpets Volunteer, written over 1,000 years ago. Something with the feel of pageantry, Chris remarked. Something to go with a coronation. Something with a regal sound. Why not? After all, this was England, so the English gave the king his due. Dickerson's posing was flawless, and if your eye was keen enough and prejudiced enough, let us say, to detect an imperfection, hell, you told yourself Chris was like the best of us, human and fallible, and you jumped and raved like the rest of the audience for Dickerson. You didn't have to hear it from Oscar State after the tumultuous pose down by the 6 finalists, Platts, Beckles, Benute, Viator, Zane, and Dickerson, to know that the last named was the new winner of the Olympia. Yes, Dickerson, who had paid his dues in Sydney and Columbus, who had the guts to come back again and again and collect his reward at 43, who would be an inspiration to those misinformed millions who believe bodybuilding was a sport only for the young. Magnanimous in defeat, Zane warmly congratulated the winner. When Platts fans reacted badly, Tom quieted them. Coe waxed philosophical. The Olympia result, he said, like life itself, was just an illusion, unquote. Makawe said he'd be back better than ever to win next time. He failed to make the final 6, yet he was good enough to dominate the Grand Prix in Sweden and in Belgium a few days after the Olympia, against the very men who stopped him at Wembley. Fuller asked only if the fans be told that he was in top shape. He was, fans. Jacques Nouville said he enjoyed playing with the men, that even though he felt out of his league at the Olympia, the experience had done him good. Fox disappeared as the 6 finalists were called on stage for the pose down. Tenorino said he was through with competition. He changed his mind a week later. Ditto Lance Dreher on both counts. It remains to be said that Oscar and his friends put on a jolly good show. Everyone said they had a great time, that the 82 Olympia was the best muscle contest they'd ever attended, especially those who never visited the Olympia on home ground in Columbus. Next stop, Munich. And then they have this short article here, analysis of the Mr. Olympia judges' marks. It said only 2 of the Olympians had final first placings from the judges. Chris Dickerson had 5 firsts from Julian Bloomhart, Walter van de Breden, Doug Evans, Ludwig Nosek, and Winston Roberts. Frank Zane was placed first by the other 2 judges, Roger Schwab and John Martin. In addition, Dickerson was placed 3rd by Schwab and Martin. Zane was placed 2nd by Nosek and Evans. Casey Viator had 5 second places from Roberts, Bloomhart, Schwab, Martin, and van de Breden, and 1 third place from Nosek. The above placings were arrived at by totaling the judges' marks for the 3 prejudging rounds and the pose down. The results indicate a fairly solid block of opinion from all 7 judges and a winner free from the controversy of the past 2 years. His final margin of 29 points over Frank Zane was clear evidence of Dickerson's superiority. There were close results between Zane and Viator, separated by 3 points, and between Beckles and Platts, separated by 2. It's undoubtedly true that the change to the placement system from the point system made the judges work harder because they had to list all the competitors in the exact order from 1st to 16th instead of grouping them in clusters of 19s, 18s, and 17s, as had been the practice in the past few years, a practice that seemed to be one of the causes of some controversial results. The judges all liked using the placement system. However, my analysis of their accuracy is based on an evaluation far more stringent than I use for the point system. I had determined a few years ago when I was experimenting with the methods of testing judges' accuracy that for the placement system, 70% is a reasonably good result. Fortunately, there are already indications that when the judges become more adept at using the system, they will be able to attain the former 80% standard of accuracy. And that was written by Oscar State. And then they've got the judges' score sheets here. And I used to love how they used to put these score sheets in the magazines with all the judges listed and all the competitors listed on the left-hand side. And then you could see every judge's score for every competitor. Nowadays, they just give 1 final placing, like a 5 or a 10. You have no idea how the judges scored it or how they scored each competitor. This one, you have three different rounds of judging. Incidentally, if you guys want to hear a good debate about posing on our Muscle Maturity podcast that is on YouTube, that is on Old School Labs' YouTube channel, if you want to go to it and hear last week's show between me and Samir Banut and Nick Trigilli, we were talking about a debate between Bob Ciccarillo and Milos Skarsev, and Milos was arguing that posing should be judged, and Bob was saying it shouldn't. So we got into a really good debate about that. But back here in 1982, the judging round was judged, and so was the muscularity round, and so was the symmetry round, and then all three of those rounds are added up. That gives you your final score, and then they're able to determine who the top six are, and then the top six pose down, and then they were able to give them the final results. So, yeah, I think that placement system was definitely much better, and it did stop all that controversy that plagued the 1980 and 81 Mr. Olympia. All right, guys, that's it for our show. We will be back next week either with Roy Callender interview, or we will have part two of our interview with Jerry Branham, where we talk about 1992 in review, and we will cover the professional competitions. Until then, have a great week, train hard, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.